The House Interim Task Force on Seniors. Today is May 9th, and we're a couple of minutes late getting started, and our apologies for that. One of the reasons, let the record show, that the staff really doesn't trust the chair with a gavel, so they failed to bring a gavel for him, and he is therefore, having to do something a little different. So please, I think it wasn't that they didn't trust him. I think there was none where there was supposed to be. And maybe that's a consequence of all of the confusion and reorganization that has taken place in the building during the last few months. At any rate, we have a fairly full agenda today, and we're going to start hoping that the rest of our committee will get here very quickly, but we have the sufficient number now to proceed. And with that, I would like to welcome the members of the committee here this morning. A real commitment on a nice sunny day. Do you have sun down in Klamath Falls, Steve?
Just recently.
I understand they've been complaining about water, and so the good Lord heard them, and they've let it snow this winter for them. And the first item on our agenda this morning will be to find out from our very capable and competent staff on what's going on, what we're supposed to be doing, and what we're looking for, and any other words of advice for us before we call Ms. Dolan to the...
Okay. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members.
But Mr. Chair, can I just say one thing before
we begin? Of course.
I'd like to wish, on behalf of the committee and myself, the chair, happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. It would be appropriate for me to reciprocate on that.
And we're a day apart, so.
Representative Girardi, happy birthday.
And Mr. Chair and committee members, you kind of took the wind out of my sail. We have treats after lunch for your birthdays.
My birthday's in June.
And your birthday, too. It's a generic birthday cake.
Oh, good.
Okay, so we'll have cake and coffee after lunch.
Great.
For both Representative Girard and the good Chair Jensen. So, and folks, if you want to come back and have cake with us, please do. Mr. Chair, committee members, this morning we're going to review on our agenda the Medicare Part D implementation. There's been a lot of activity around that. The committee has not heard about that since most of the activities started happening post sine die of the session, and the deadline for enrollment is coming up next week, so I thought the committee would be in a good position to hear what's happened, what is happening, what they're anticipating to come even here in the next few weeks. So we have several panels to speak to you on that. Later on this morning, we are talking about the swing bed policy in Oregon that has an impact in some of our rural, our hospitals, but primarily it is a tool used in rural and small community hospitals. So we're going to do some informational and background information on swing beds. And then this afternoon we go into Oregon Project Independence, how the legislation that we passed in 2005, creating the special fund for OPI, how that's going, the status of it. We have legislative fiscal coming in to do that. And then Jacqueline Zimmer is coming in to give us an update on the Oregon Area Agencies on Aging, the O4ADs, and their projects, programs, and status of how they're doing. So we're covering a lot of ground today, Mr. Chair.
Oh, thank you, Sandy. Appreciate that. And with that, if we could then, Missy Dolan, Office of Oregon Policy and Research. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Jensen and committee members. Thank you for inviting me here today. For the record, my name is Missy Dolan. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, and my birthday is May 22nd.
Well, welcome to the great month of May.
That's right. As you are all familiar, the Oregon Prescription Drug Program was authorized under Senate Bill 875 in 2003. It was known as the bulk purchasing pool, and it is for certain uninsured individuals and for public sector groups. At the end of March of this year, after going live a year ago March, we have 3,534 uninsured enrolled, and we have 4,000 group members enrolled, and we have 23,000 members in about half a dozen groups currently seeking quotes from the program. Savings for the uninsured for the 13 months ending March 31st were $460,000. That averages to $26 per prescription. We have 80% generic usage on the uninsured population, and discounts can be as high as 60% on the drugs. The program has performed bilingual outreach, including legislative-sponsored sign-ups with translators. We've done outreach to immigrants and refugees. We've gone to inner-city shelters and neighborhood organizations. We've gone to all four corners of the state. And we've done outreach to over 400 faith-based organizations and safety nets all over the state. You can see from the map on page 3 that we have actually penetrated every county in the state. Savings have been demonstrated for every group that has come to us and asked us to quote. The first two groups were enrolled 3 months after launching with the uninsured. PEB recently joined in January of this year in the counties of Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln with 3,000 members. If nothing else, the OPDP brings a group an alternative, which gives them some competitive advantage when they're negotiating renewals. We have formed a pharmacy and therapeutics committee. We've developed a preferred drug list that's based on evidence-based research, and it's a voluntary drug list for groups and for the uninsured. However, we believe that the tools that we've formed from this drug list is part of the reason that we have such a high generic usage in our uninsured. Other states that we've looked at that have similar programs are running 60 to 68% generic usage, and ours is up at the 80% level. We have 550 pharmacies that have voluntarily joined our program, and that represents about 86% of all the pharmacies in this state. The non-participating pharmacies are primarily in urban areas where there is very credible coverage already. Encouraging the generic usage through the evidence-based research and lowest cost criteria is actually better for the pharmacies because the pharmacies have a greater margin on generic drugs, so they still can make money by giving us good discounts. And on page 5, I've got a map that demonstrates where the current pharmacies are and where our coverage is. So in those areas where you don't see any pharmacies, there aren't any pharmacies. As far as Medicare Part D goes, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid has actually granted the OPD a special privilege, and that is to allow our out-of-pocket expense, our members' out-of-pocket expense, to be accumulated towards true out-of-pocket expense for Medicare, which means that if a member has a better discount by using their OPDP card, they can use that and they can turn their receipt in to their plan, and the plan can actually credit it towards their true out-of-pocket expense. Now, the challenge is that this is currently a manual process. They actually have to submit their receipts to their plan for that to be done. However, James Whitfield, the director of Medicare Region 10 in Washington, is actually appealing to Medicare for us to try to get in an automated solution so that it can just be done seamlessly at the pharmacy. Overall, the program has increased access to pharmaceuticals for the uninsured. It provides tools to encourage smarter purchasing. It reduces cost trends for the public sector groups that have joined. And it uses medical guidelines based on scientific evidence, all required by the statute. So that's my update. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
One of the things, and I think I understood, you know, what you're doing in relationship to the Medicare, but could you, in this last part of your update, run that through again for me?
Absolutely. When you go to the pharmacy, you can actually carry the OPDP discount card, and you can carry your plan card. For example, if you have a Part D coverage through Regents Blue Cross, you can put both cards down, and the pharmacist can tell you, for this drug, you're going to get a 60% discount from OPDP, which might be better than Regents. So you could actually apply that discount instead of the Regents discount. And then your out-of-pocket expense for that drug, you take your receipt, you send it to Regents, and Regents can actually accumulate it towards your Medicare out-of-pocket expense, which is called true out-of-pocket expense. So that was a big step for Medicare to take to allow us to have that integration capability.
Question? Yes.
What if you already have a private insurance plan, are you eligible for this program?
Chair Jensen and Representative Garrard, you are not eligible if you have private health insurance that includes RX coverage. But Medicare is not private.
Understand. Good morning and welcome, Representative Nelson. And just as a little digression, I understand that you're missing our first session way back when was most defensible because you were pursuing your credentialing and teaching, and you have, as I believe, if I understood correctly, accomplished that.
Yeah.
Our congratulations
Thank
to you.
You. Thank you. I found out I wasn't brain dead. But my goodness, trigonometry and calculus and algebra and
you could have
geometry got me.
Provided you that information without you going to all of that trouble.
Oh, thank you. Oh, my goodness, what those elementary kids have to learn. I mean, all of us should go back to school, but thank you, and I do apologize because
that's fine.
Task force does mean everything to me. I probably missed it, but how many are eligible totally for this program? I see that... you know, you say there's 3,500 uninsured.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the total that are eligible?
No. Chair Jensen and Representative Nelson, in response to that, we estimate that there are approximately 150,000 Oregonians who are eligible for the pool at this point in the uninsured portion. So that's uninsured in individuals. That doesn't include the private sector or the public sector. Of those 150,000, we estimate that 120,000 are Medicare age. So only 30,000 are between the ages of 54 and 64. This program is only available to people who are 54 years old at 185% of the federal poverty level with no private health insurance with RX coverage, and you have to be an Oregon resident.
And a follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
Mr. Chair. What is that federal poverty level right now?
In 2006, it's 18,100.
And for one person?
Right.
And this does include just that person or?
We look at eligibility individually.
Individually.
Because we have to look at age. We have to look at whether they are covered or not and whether they're a resident or not.
One more follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you. Also, I found out from our meeting yesterday that for our veterans, we're just lacking. We are just bad when it comes to communicating this, you know, our various programs for our veterans. For example, we find veterans 10 years ago could have gotten benefits and maybe just now finding out. And I'm just wondering, what is the communication program? I don't see a lot on... TV, you know, I just don't know where people would find out that they are eligible.
Right. We don't have a budget for TV. Matter of fact, we don't have a budget for much outreach at all, and I think that the outreach we have done has been pretty remarkable considering the limited budget for this program. However, we have, on the public sector side, we actually sent invitations to all elected officials all over the state, and I've got enough that I can give the committee members copies of these invitations. And you may not have been here yet, Representative Nelson, but we actually sent over 400 packets. The packets are about this size. They include frequently asked questions and applications and a letter of introduction about the program to safety nets all over the state, including SHIBA, including senior centers, faith-based organizations. Anything that we could find, we sent. We have visited those centers. We continue outreach as much as we can. So we have had a lot of assistance with organizations like AARP and Oregonians for Health Security. As a matter of fact, in the first year of implementation, AARP gave us a couple hundred thousand dollars worth of outreach in terms of mailers and customer service support and calling. And so advocacy groups have stepped up and really helped us with outreach. But it's a problem. It's a problem getting to the people that need it.
Thank you.
Would you allow me one more?
One?
One, okay. I promise.
Go ahead, please.
Because this is, we've been talking about this, but because we seem to be really remiss at the state in many, many programs in, you know, how to, we can't put up big boards in every town, but would it be possible to just get a basic budgetary number from you to what you think would be an adequate communication program, a marketing-based program to you know, fully advocate for this program, which is excellent.
Right. Representative Nelson, we have submitted the budget for the 07-09, and it includes a pretty sizable increase in the outreach for the program.
Do you recall what that is, what that number is?
The total number for the two-year period is approximately
$700,000.
Representative Grott.
Just a note of trivia, Mr. Chair.
Please.
It's interesting to note that members of the legislature, based on their annual salary, now qualify for this program at 185% of the poverty level. I just got it.
Thank you. That is not trivia. That's important to me.
Are there questions on this? Would you like a little update? Or?
No, thank you. I don't want to abuse the committee's time. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, ma'am. And welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
A couple of questions. Understanding that one of the roles of this committee, this task force, we've been given the classic dilemma to solve, and that is, how do we deliver more service for less money and improve the quality of the service at the same time? With this, we're looking at 3,500 out of probably 30,000 that one would think have a pretty significant need. Is that right?
That's right.
What type of costs would there be involved for the state if we improve this to 25,000 out of 30,000? What is this costing us to do this? That's my question. And we'll follow that with a concern about what are we getting, you know, for that. So could you help me with that a little bit?
Sure. Well, currently, this is the first year of implementation. The uninsured saw a savings of $460,000. The budget for the current biennium is $350,000, and that includes outreach, and it includes salary. It's everything for 2 years. That doesn't include the I haven't told you about the savings for the groups. Crook County School District is probably saving in the area of $3,000 a month by being a part of this program. They're a group of about 1,000 members. We expect the PEB members to see savings in Crook County, in the Lynn Benton counties. I think, as I've said, that every time a group brings us to the table, their carriers are incented to be more creative in cost cutting. So there's that sentinel effect, if you will, that the program can have just by bringing us to the table. And so that's a number that I couldn't give you, but it's out there. And we are being asked to quote constantly to groups. I've made presentations to the largest brokerage houses in the state. I've got another one coming up in a week to JBL&K, to all of their sales staff. So, and they're inviting me. Labor has been inviting me. Labor has been going to management in the different districts and asking for OPDP to be at the table. And quite honestly, management is pleased to do it, because if we can do anything to drive the cost down, it's wonderful, even if they don't come into the program. So I think it's got a very positive, it's had a very positive effect. I think that, as Representative Nelson points out, it's imperative that we reach all the people that we can, and we are pounding the pavement trying to do it. We have a lot of faith-based organizations who are interested in helping us. We got a call last week from a clinic who said, I have homeless people. I have at least 20 homeless people that would be eligible for your program. Can I list our address as their address, because they don't have addresses? And we have, as the word is getting out to organizations that we're there, they're calling us. So I think that what you've seen is the success of a program in 12 months. The prior prescription drug program, which was, you know, a wonderful program, but it had a $50 a year membership fee. And they never got more than 250 people enrolled on that program after 2.5-3 years. So to have 3,500 after 12 months and to have another 4,000 in groups, this program is already a success. It's going nowhere but up.
I appreciate that. The real question, I guess, and I probably phrased it incorrectly, if we increase membership from 3,500 to 20,000, it actually costs. It's my understanding that additional amount of drugs that will be run through the program then is not a cost to the state?
No.
It is paid for by the pooling?
The only cost to the program of increasing the membership is we have a per claim fee that we pay to our pharmacy benefit administrator. But we actually negotiated in that contract that the fee goes down as the enrollment goes up. And it eventually goes down to zero. So the best thing that could happen to this pool is it got to 100,000 members, because then it would go down to zero. Not only that, but I've been applying for grants for the past 2 years. And we were actually told by a local foundation that the primary reason we didn't get their grant, the grant that we requested just about 4 months ago, was that our ability to grow was so small in relation to Medicare coming on January 1st and possibly taking 120,000 of our eligibles away and leaving us with just a pool of 30,000. Instead, they gave Lane County, a new Lane County RX program, a grant, because they had the capacity of reaching over 60,000 people. So by keeping the pool small, we're actually hurting ourselves because we're not, you know, we can't get the grant money. And I've applied to at least six grants. I've been asked to fill two full grant applications. You know, you send a letter of interest, and but we can't reach enough people. So I think the more people we reach, the greater the opportunity for funding through foundations. And like I said, the PDA gets down to zero on a per claim cost. So we start covering our costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And please forgive me if this has already been covered. But I wonder, Ms. Dolan, if you have any capacity to do an analysis of how much either value or numbers of the prescriptions that your participants are purchasing are prescriptions that they would otherwise have purchased and paid retail for, as compared with how much of that benefit is benefit people wouldn't have gotten at all because they couldn't afford to pay retail.
I don't think I have the ability to say that they wouldn't be able to buy it. I believe that increasing or reducing the cost, you're going to increase the access. I think that's a no-brainer. But I don't think I could put a dollar amount on that figure. We did do a survey. Excuse me, Chair Jensen and Representative Nolan. We did do a survey before we started the program of all of the, not all, but many of the Portland area pharmacies and the Salem area pharmacies. We used the same drug list, and we saw that if I called and said I was 54 years old and I met all the criteria and I didn't have insurance, what was I going to pay for, say, Lipitor? And we got those prices. And the pharmacies were already giving about a 10% break across the line. They would give you 10% if you walked in. So what we say is, taking that into consideration, the approximately 45% average discount that we're seeing, I go on the road and I say it's probably 30. You're seeing 30% more by joining this program, because I believe you'd probably get 10% if you went to the pharmacy, so I don't tell them to expect 40. I also think that by giving the uninsured members the tools, and I did bring some of our tools that it has dollar signs and it has smiley faces for drugs under $10. And this is our evidence-based list that we were required by statute to develop. I think that it has encouraged more generic usage. I don't think you were here, but we have an 80% generic usage, which is really extraordinary. And so I think they look at this, and we encourage them. We send them a letter, and we encourage them to talk to their doctors if they see a drug that's cheaper than the one they're taking, and ask them, why can't I be on that drug? Mm-hmm. So I think we're having, if they go to a generic drug, which many of them are, they're going to get a greater discount. The 60% discounts are available on generics. That's better for the pharmacy, because the pharmacy has a much greater margin on generic drugs. They can afford to give us 60% and still make money. And yet, you know, I've told many a senior who tell me, I'm only taking one drug for $30 a month. I said, well, what if I can get it to you for $12 a month? And they say, where's the application?
Mr. Chair, just a comment to follow up. It seems to me that there are two benefits for this program, and the one is obvious, and that is the savings to the people who participate and their capacity to use that money for other of life's essentials. But the other, and I understand that it may be difficult to measure, but it seems to me there ought to be a public health benefit as well, and that is that more people are getting either the care at all or an appropriate level of care that they hadn't previously gotten. There are anecdotal stories about people who are cutting their pills in half to stretch it out.
Yep.
And that may not show up as something they couldn't afford, but under this program, they could actually afford to take the dose they're supposed to be taking and that improves public health. So I'm interested, as we move through time, in looking at both the benefits, not only the personal benefits to the participants, but the public health benefit of improved conditions for our citizens.
I might add with that, Representative, that they may not have to make the choice between eating and medicine.
Exactly.
If they can have that margin, additional margin. Representative Grimes.
Ms. Dolan, I represent one of the poorest districts in the state. I go back to my senior center and I talk to my seniors. How is this program implemented at the local level? Where do I tell them to go if they're eligible to enroll in this program?
Chair Jensen and Representative Garrard, we have actually visited, my colleague and I have gone down to your area and met with several senior centers and government agencies and even faith-based organizations down there. We have sent them packets with applications, but the easiest thing for you to tell them is our 1-800 number. It's actually 1-888-411-OPDP. Or they can go on our website, www.opdp.org, and they can download an application. It's an extremely easy application. Name and address, you know, you are attesting to your eligibility. I'll leave these with you. It's one page. They fill it in. They send it in. Couldn't be easier. We've circulated these. That's what I meant by over 400 of these packets were sent all over. We've actually sent notices, informational notices to all the legislators. I think it was over the summer, so you may not have received it yet. But telling about the program. But I think the 800 number and the website are the quickest access. You don't have the seniors don't have to go to a facility. If they don't have a computer, that's a different story. These can be copied. These applications can be copied and distributed at will. So you could even call our office and ask for 100 of these to be sent to you.
Follow up. Yeah, just I find a lot of seniors don't have computers or computer skills.
Right.
So having the telephone number is very appropriate, and I appreciate that very much.
You bet. And I just want to say that recently we had some great radio coverage down in your area, and following that, we received probably 50 or 60 applications within about a three-week period. It was followed up with some newspaper articles, and people just started calling us like crazy. So it was great. Any kind of coverage that we get is usually we get a firestorm of activity afterwards. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Last question.
Yes, thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Representative Nelson, yes.
Thank you. Ms. Dolan, thank you. I think you're awesome. Appreciate y'all. Do you work with our Hunger Task Force and the Meals on Wheels? Do they have these brochures and applications?
So yes, we send
them out regularly.
Chair Jensen and Representative Nelson, we have sent them to Meals on Wheels. We've sent them to, like I said, every
the Hunger Task Force.
I'll find out, and if we haven't, I'll send them.
Thank you.
Yeah, any advice that you would have, I'd be happy to follow your recommendations.
Thank you, Ms. Dolan, and we probably could take a little more time, but in the interest of the schedule, I think we need to move on. So we appreciate very much, and thank you very much for the hard work, and we will look forward to, by the time we go into session, increasing 3,500 up to somewhere 20,000. That's our goal. Okay.
With your help, sir.
Okay. with that, then, were we contemplating a panel of people coming up or one at a time?
What's the dual panel? They all feed into each other.
Are they all speaking to each other?
No, they interface with each other.
Oh.
So,
okay.
But I'm not sure if the Oregon Pharmacy Association has sent somebody.
the Oregon Pharmacy Association being represented here,
okay,
here today?
Okay. They were unsure.
They were unsure. Okay. We've got Jean Allen Widens, is that correct?
Yes.
Claudia Grimm and Annie Markaby. Jean Allen with the Medicare Modernization Act, Department of Human Services. And the issue here is Part D implementation, and the chair would be real interested in this. I understand that we still have some seniors out there that haven't signed up.
The time is running out.
And that would cause us, I suppose, a little concern, because, but we'll let you tell your story.
Thank you. Chairman Jensen and members of the committee, my name is Jane Ellen Whiteanth. I'm with the Oregon Department of Human Services, and I've had the pleasure for the last year and a couple of months to be the Medicare Modernization Act project manager for the department. And what that really has meant is that there has been significant changes for Medicaid clients that also have Medicare in the state of Oregon, and it's been my job to really implement that. And with partnerships across the state with our area agencies on aging, with our county developmental disability programs, with the SHEBA program, with our insurance agents, long-term care pharmacies, bringing together partnerships and really working together across the state to implement this, not just for the clients of the Department of Human Services, but across for all of the seniors in Oregon. And I'm going to give you a quick overview over the program and then speak a little bit about specifically the clients of the Department of Human Services and the changes that have happened because of the Medicare prescription drug program, and then we'll turn it over to Claudia to talk about community partnerships and what they've been working on, and then from one of the prescription drug plans, Annie will talk about the issues that they've been facing as a prescription drug plan here in Oregon. To start with, there's approximately 540,000 seniors and people with disabilities in the state of Oregon that also have Medicare. Those individuals, starting in November of last year, of 2005, had the opportunity to enroll in a prescription drug plan. And these prescription drug plans, unlike the rest of the Medicare program, are private insurance companies where each of them can have different designs. They can offer different drugs, they can have different copayment structures, different premium structures, and different formulary controls. You not only have these private insurance companies, but you also have employer plans that offer Medicare, what they call creditable coverage, coverage that is as good or better than Medicare's, and then you also have the Medicaid program in there as well. And all of these choices combined mean that there's more than 96 different choices in the state of Oregon for people to choose from. And to me, part of this has been that the federal government has done a great job of trying to get the information out there. Local partners have been doing the same thing. But to a large degree, because this is brand new, it's like going into a candy store with jars that you can't see what the candy looks like, and you're trying to reach in and grab the right one for you. That's been very confusing for all seniors across the state, especially when they're trying to make a decision and they're hearing some of the problems that have happened.
Well, Chairman Rick. Understand the confusion of that, but just as information for the committee, or at least for the chair, if I'm advising a senior on this, it is better that they pick one, which they then may at some future date change and still be on Part D, as contrasted to doing nothing. Is that correct?
Chairman Jensen, you're right to a large degree. If a person doesn't currently have coverage, then their best option is to pick something. My mom is a great example. She doesn't want to. She hates paying insurance. She thinks it's a ripoff, and I always have to argue with her about these things. And I'm like, Mom, pick the $7 one. That way you'll never have to pay a penalty in the future. You'll always be able to change plans once a year if it's not working for you. So pick the cheap one if you're not going to enroll in one that really meets all your needs. But it's complicated because if you also have insurance coverage through your former employer or through your union, and you're receiving those benefits through them in a comprehensive health package, if you enroll in a prescription drug plan, you can actually end up getting disenrolled from your entire medical package through your employer and union plan. Now, most companies are being very forgiving and working with their members to get them back enrolled in their health plan, but that is one of the impacts. You have to, so every single individual has to be counseled individually to make sure that they're not making a bad choice. Because you need to choose, does this plan cover my drugs? Well, one, do I even need it? Or do I have other coverage? If I do need it, does it cover my drugs? Does it work with my pharmacy? And are the savings that I'm going to see, even though I now am paying a premium, are those worth what I'm going to do? And my mom's point is that she takes vitamins. She doesn't take anything else other than vitamins. And so she doesn't see the value to it. And what I've had to convince her to is it's just like car insurance, and you have to have it there in case something happens. And it actually did. 2 months after she enrolled in a Medicare prescription drug program, after I twisted her arm on Thanksgiving, she actually went into the doctor's office. Actually, it was 2 months. She came out with 8 different prescriptions. A couple $150, $250 for each one of them if she hadn't been enrolled in a prescription drug plan. So for a lot of people, this has been a wonderful thing. It will continue to be a wonderful thing. And I think over time we will see a lot of the problems smooth out, and we will start to see some stabilization of the program and people making choices. There is still a tremendous number of people who have not enrolled and who are waiting until the last minute, and I think Claudia can talk about that and the impact that that's happening, having on her program. What, as you know, people have until May 15th to make a decision, and then they are locked into that decision until next year. Open enrollment will start in November of 06 with an effective date of January of 07. So people really do need to make a decision now. And there's a lot of information out there, but people, because there are so many different options and because people have been scared by all of the bad media, a lot of people are waiting and are not making a decision. A subcategory of this population, that's of the 540,000 that I mentioned, is about 72,000 individuals who also receive assistance through the Department of Human Services. This has probably been one of the most difficult transitions that these people have ever gone through, and I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about that. What happened is on January 1st, Medicare took over the prescription drug portion of these people's health plan instead of them getting their prescriptions through the Oregon Department of Human Services Medicaid program. So on December 31st, the state was paying for these people's drugs. January 1st, Medicare picked it up. To make sure that that happened effectively, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services actually auto-enrolled all of what they call the dual-eligible individuals into a plan randomly. So the 12 plans that were available in Oregon, each got a 12th of the dual-eligible population. That caused a lot of concerns for us because that didn't mean that that plan was going to be the best plan for that individual. So over the fall, our local offices and our community partners, including the area agencies on aging that I mentioned earlier, and our long-term care providers and our pharmacies all partnered together to help individuals pick a plan that would better meet their needs. Since this is mostly, and the best tools available out there are based in the computer, it was really sitting down with each senior citizen or each person with a disability and saying, do you need help or do you have someone who can help you? If not, give me a list of your drugs. You type in their drugs. You type in their pharmacy, and it tells you which plans work with that pharmacy and cover those drugs. We did that for about 25,000 individuals who needed assistance during the fall. We were hoping that that would mean that in January 1st that this transition would be smooth and I would be able to go home and have a nice day off. And what we found when we got back to work on January 3rd is that the transition was not a smooth transition. Many of the clients for the Department of Human Services were still enrolled in their auto-enrolled plan and the plan that they had chosen. That wasn't supposed to happen. They were supposed to be guaranteed a 90-day supply of their current medications that they were stable on. That didn't happen for many of our clients. And what we found was between 15 to 20,000 of our clients, about almost half, not quite half, were really having significant problems. they could not, they would go to the pharmacy and they would be turned away or they would be charged $250, $500, $1,000. One client was told that they had to pony up $1,000 right away. And these are very extremely low-income individuals. They qualify for Medicaid. They're the lowest-income population that we have in the state. And they were used to a very comprehensive prescription program and used to no copayments. So now they have mandatory copayments, and at the same time, the program wasn't working for them. The department with our partners pulled together immediately and tried to figure out a strategy. We started working with the Centers for Medicare and Medicare Services to really, excuse me, Medicare and Medicaid Services, started working strategies to resolve the problems. And we think that at this point, most of those critical system failures have started to be resolved. If you ask me, if we were at a negative 10 in implementation in January, we're probably at a 4 or 5 today. We still have clients having problems with getting their medications, mostly because of formulary problems where the drug's not on the approved list for that particular insurance company, and the client doesn't understand the process to go through. We still have clients that are enrolled in two plans, and then they get disenrolled from both of them so that they don't have insurance coverage. And on January 13th, because of all the ongoing problems, the governor actually allowed the department and asked the department to come up with a plan to start paying for prescriptions for the individuals who were in these critical problems where they were walking out of the pharmacy with no drugs and were running out of their medications. And so since January 13th, we've served close to 5,000 people in getting them their medications. So we do case management and help tons of people, 20,000 people, get their problems resolved. And we've actually had to pay for the drugs for about 5,000 of those individuals. We're starting to taper that off. We are trying to work with pharmacies and the prescription drug plans, and the goal is to really terminate that special assistance by the end of this month if we can. We do think that there could be ongoing problems where people can't make their copayments. They didn't used to pay them. Now they have to pay them. And unlike Medicaid, in the Medicare program, if someone doesn't have their copayment money, the pharmacy can turn them away. And we know that that's a real problem for our community-based care facilities like our assisted living facilities and our adult foster homes because they have to provide quality care, which includes access to quality prescriptions. But then if the client can't pay the copayments, they run into this cycle of trying to resolve these problems. And it's a huge burden on our long-term care providers. So now I've just kind of given you a very quick overview of all the problems. Let me tell you that our Oregon-based insurance companies that have taken on this challenge of offering this new program have been amazing to work with, and you've probably got one of the best sitting here with us today. It's not all bleak. This is a good program for a lot of people. It will help a lot of people. It's been difficult, especially for the dual-eligible populations, but a lot of our insurance companies that are here in Oregon, Care Oregon, Family Care, Samaritan Advantage, all over the state, these homegrown organizations have really stepped up to the plate and done what's right in Oregon. And so I'd like to thank them for that because without their help, we would have been in a much worse situation than we've been so far.
One question, Jane Ellen. When we're out of this 75,000 people who were on, I assume, Medicaid,
mm-hmm.
And went to, you enrolled them then in Part D,
mm-hmm.
or some of them who didn't enroll themselves, and then they wound up with a copay,
mm-hmm.
which some of them, and probably most of them, if they're on Medicaid, would have had difficulty paying. Why didn't we just go ahead and work it so that we continue to pick up the money for the drugs, only instead of paying the full amount that you'd have had to pay before, that Medicaid would have had to pay before, they don't have to pay the copay?
Chairman Jensen, that's a great question, and it's a complicated answer, unfortunately. Part of the problem is that the federal law, the Medicare Modernization Act of 1995, woo, where did the whole last decade go? 2005, actually prohibited the states from using Medicaid money, which is a match between the federal funding and the state funding, using it to cover any drug that could be covered by a prescription drug plan. So we would have had to fund that solely out of the state general fund, and the legislature was not able to find that money during the session, is the real answer. There, the Ways and Means Committee...
Could I argue as a... as a Medicaid person out there that this is just because the plan, this other plan is going to pay for 65% of the drug, that it isn't covering the drug because 65% is inadequate for me to... Or is that too difficult an argument with too big a brother to have to deal with?
Chairman Jensen, I think actually I forgot to tell you a piece that I should have made sure I'd spoken about. Low-income individuals, people who have incomes under 150% of the federal poverty level, actually qualify for something called the Low-Income Subsidy Program. That program subsidizes both the premiums and the co-payments.
Okay.
So unlike a general Medicare population like my mother who pays 25% of her drugs, our dual-eligible population actually is limited between $1 and $5 for their co-payments of their drugs, which doesn't sound like a lot, but when you only have $580 a month, $1 and $3 can be a lot of money, especially when you're struggling already with higher utility bills, et cetera. So it's a minimal amount, and I think that Congress's intent was that the individuals would actually have some responsibility for their health care. I would argue that for this population, they don't actually question their doctors about, should I take this medication or should I take this medication. We can help educate them, and we've been doing that through the Medicaid program, showing them more cost-effective medications or as effective medications. But they take what their doctor prescribes, and so they may take 30 or 40 medications. In fact, we have one gentleman that we know of that we've seen so far take 66 medications. And we've, I mentioned to the Senate committee when I was talking to them that we've been gently talking to doctors' offices about that to see if there's something we could do to help lower those costs for those individuals. But I've learned that it's very difficult to tell doctors what to do. They don't seem to like that too much, especially when I'm not a medical professional. So, but we are gently calling those doctors and or the offices and asking if they can review it and see if there's something they can do to help lower that cost for those individuals. But it is expensive, and it does add up for these individuals. And unfortunately, the e-board just was not able to, or excuse me, the Ways and Means during the session was not able to get right to the point where they could fund this.
Thank you. There other questions? I guess, you know, I've heard of the bionic man that's just gone to the chemical man. I thought I was bad about taking the amount of medicines I have to take. Claudia, please. Ms. Grimm.
Good morning, Chair Jensen and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Claudia Grimm, and I am the program manager for the Senior Health Insurance Benefits Assistance Program, or SHIBA. And for purposes of my talk today, I'll be referring to the activity summary with the date on the bottom of May 9th, 2006. For those of you who don't know, SHIBA is a program that's administered primarily at the local level. We recruit and train retired senior volunteers to provide objective counseling services to Medicare beneficiaries on a variety of topics, and typically we were doing counseling with regard to Medicare A and B and Medigap supplements, Medicare Advantage. We helped with billing questions, and in 2005 our directive from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, was to help with the implementation of a new prescription drug benefit called Medicare Part D. For those of you who don't know, SHIBA is part of a larger network of state health insurance programs, and there are similar programs to what we have here in Oregon in all 50 states, and these were founded in 1992 as part of the Federal Omnibus Reconciliation Act. In Oregon, our program is housed as part of the Department of Business and Consumer Services and was part of the Insurance Division. However, last July 1st, 2005, administration of the program was transferred to Rocky King, who also administers FEOP, the Family Health Insurance Program, and OMIP, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. Our program in Oregon is funded primarily through an annual federal grant from CMS, And it's a non-competitive grant, and it's based on a formula. And that formula is the number of Medicare beneficiaries residing in our state, Oregon, compared to the nation as a whole. So when you look at states like Texas, California, Florida, you can see that Oregon is a relatively small state, and therefore we don't receive a lot of funds from CMS. This year, for 2006-2007, specifically April 1st, 2006 to March 31st, 2007, Oregon submitted a grant for approximately $1.2 million to CMS. And of this $1.2 million, we were going to direct $600,000, over half of it, to local communities to help with the implementation and cover the costs at the local level to really do the work that we know needs to be done. This $1.2 million was supported by the governor, and Governor Kulongowski did write a letter of support to be funded in this amount to CMS. And during the first week of April, we were told that we would receive exactly the same amount of money we received last year for Oregon Sheba, which is $356,685. We also, in addition to those monies, we receive a small grant from the Department of Human Services, State Agency on Aging. And that is for specifically Medicare fraud and abuse, to educate seniors on how to protect themselves from Medicare fraud and abuse. And last year, that was approximately $56,000. So with that in mind, looking at what we've been able to do with the money that we have, the latest report from CMS dated April 18th of this year, of the 540,000 folks that we know are eligible for Medicare and to be enrolled in Part D, we have still 173,699 folks who are eligible who do still lack credible coverage based on that April 18th report date. Now, people are then, how did they enroll? Some of them were the full duals and partial duals that my colleague Jane Ellen mentioned. They were auto-enrolled. Some of them already had creditable coverage because they were veterans or had former employee coverage. And some of them were the folks that we helped sign up and enroll in this new program. What I think is very interesting is that when these figures came out in Region 10, which is Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Alaska, we had the highest enrollment figures. And when you look at Washington and Idaho that receive a large amount of general fund to help with their SHEBA programs, I thought that was pretty amazing that we've been able to do the work we've been able to do with the small amount of funding we have. So let's talk about the volunteers, because they're really the people who are out there doing the work. On July 1st, when Mr. King took over the program, there was about 160 SHEBA volunteers statewide. And when I say volunteers, these aren't the people where I say, Jane Ellen, can you come over on Saturday? We're selling Girl Scout cookies. Can you volunteer? These are folks that that fill out a volunteer application. We check their credentials. They spend 2 to 3 days in training on all aspects of Medicare, and then they have a 10-hour internship with a qualified counselor who then says, yes, this person is qualified to be a full SHEBA counselor or not. And one of the new criteria for this Medicare D program was obviously computer literacy. We needed to have senior volunteers that knew how to use a computer and navigate the Medicare.gov website. So at the end of February, after a bunch of trainings that were sponsored by DHS and we participated in, we had about 500 volunteers. And for purposes of implementing Medicare D, we implemented a SHEBA Lite. And that was for 4 hours of training, a six-month commitment. That's all we're asking. Will you be willing to help us with Medicare D? And we got a lot of people saying yes. And then, as you can see, by the end of April 30th, that number has decreased. We've seen some attrition. People are done with their six-month commitment. What is really interesting about volunteers that I'd like to note is of those 300, and this is across the state, whether you're in Jackson County, Klamath County, Multnomah County, these folks want the full three-day training. They want to continue working for the program, and I think that that's a real testament to our local program sponsors and the support that they're able to provide without a lot of financial backing. If you look at our call log for our central office, our toll-free line, and I apologize, we get our numbers from our phone bill, and our phone bill for April won't be until about the 15th of the month. You go back to a peak of about 4,000 calls a month in November. These were 5, 10, 15-minute general question calls, very short. And then you see our phone volume just going down, and not just small decreases. It's really going down. But what we're finding is that even though last March we had gone from a high of 4,000, we were down to about 1,500 calls a month. These were calls that were taking 20, 30, sometimes up to 60 minutes to talk to a person. These were requiring extra research, either one of our counselors contacting a plan, waiting on hold to talk to a customer service rep to be able to give a client an answer based on their unique situation. So although the number of calls was decreasing, what we were seeing go up is the complexity of those calls, and that it required a lot of extra outside research and time for our staff, and then calls back, which are not captured in this phone log because the AT&T only captures calls coming in. So that's pretty interesting. Our call volume, because we do keep records, every customer service staff keeps a record, on April 10th started increasing, and as we predicted after tax day, I think our AT&T records will really show that the volume has gone up. Yesterday when I talked to staff, there were calls that were 1.5 to 2 hours in length. The Medicare deadline to enroll is a catalyst in getting people who have other problems with the Medicare system in general, and they are not easy calls, and I'm sure you'll hear the same from Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. So they're coming in fast, and they're coming in strong. So what have we done in terms of outreach and client contact? CMS requires the SHEBA program for every one-on-one contact to fill out a form that says we spent X number of minutes, X number of hours, one-on-one with every client. But often, as I demonstrated with what's happening in our central office, there's additional research that needs to be done, additional activities, and I didn't really have a good feel of what that looked like in the field at the local level until we got our biannual, twice a year we do a resource report, and on that report, the local coordinators report total number of volunteer hours spent in preparation for a call, perhaps attending a training that will give them new information on what the latest changes in Medicare and the plans. And what I found was very interesting, and I didn't know Representative Nelson knew so much about math, because my math is not very accurate on this, but I wanted to give you kind of a big picture. If you look at the client contact data in the middle of page 2, between July 1, 05 and March 31st, 06, we logged a total of directly 2,500 counseling hours. When I look at the latest resource report that shows all the hours, total, aggregated total that counselors take in really working with clients, and this isn't scientific because the date that I have for that report begins on October 1st, so I'm missing July, August, and September, we see a total of 15,633 total volunteer hours spent. So what that sort of tells me in a very abstract way is that for every hour that a counselor spends one-on-one talking to a client, they're doing approximately 5 hours worth of work in preparation and follow-up and really learning how to deal with this case. And I think this is very important, so I'm going to take the time to explain to you three reasons why I think it's important. And the first has to do with the number of our volunteers, which we saw decrease. I figured it's the attrition due to the small six-month commitment they had made. But the nature of this particular volunteer program, I think, is that we have high-level volunteers who have a high cognitive capacity, who are able to deal with complex information and complex situations, and it's not the Girl Scout cookie sale. These are really retired professional folks that have a certain nature to assimilate and be able to communicate, is the other key, very complex information. I think that this information is important also because of funding, which is always the big elephant in the room. And I think what I'm asking myself and what Mr. King is asking himself is, how do we sustain and support the momentum that the volunteers have generated at the local level for this program? And I think that Medicare D has done more to raise the profile of this program in our state than any other program. People know we exist. They're a resource. They're going to call SHEBA for help. They're going to call our 800 number. And I also see that we have one of the largest cohorts in history that's going to turn 65 in just a few years. And when I was at a Senior and Boomer Expo, there were many people that came by, oh, I'm only 62. I don't need to know about that yet. I'm not ready for that yet. So we have a whole bunch of people that are going to need to know about Medicare, the A, B, C's, D's, and wherever we are in the alphabet soup after that. But I think that always in the back of our mind, how do we fund a program that we know is successful? And the third thing that I want to point out is the savings to the state. And again, this isn't very accurate, but I did a Google search on what the prevailing federal rate was for volunteers. If we were going to pay volunteers to pay for the $15,633 hours that they spent in the last 6 months providing volunteer services, we assigned that $17.55. That shows a savings to the state of approximately $274,359, savings that had you hired state staff to provide this service, you would have been paying out, and instead we have volunteers that are providing the service. It really is a valuable program because we are saving the state money and being able to provide this service. I wanted just to finish up by talking about our statewide public and media activities, and of course I would be remiss if I didn't mention our partners, so I'm going to do that right now because I didn't last time and some people got mad. But at the national level, we have CMS, Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, and Social Security. At the state level, of course, Department of Human Services, Office of Health Policy and Research. If you didn't know, they contracted and hired a communications consultant to help coordinate the activities, the fairs, the enrollment events, and that was a great service to us. Also, our state unit on aging and private partners are the Medicare RX Access Network. They're sort of a conglomeration of various groups and individuals, and AARP Oregon. And I would be very remiss if I didn't mention our state legislature, because every one of you has had a town hall in your community. If I haven't spoken or a SHEBA staff haven't spoken, you've gotten someone on more than one occasion, many of you, a very bipartisan, wonderful effort on behalf of the whole legislature to really let folks know in your communities this is going on and this is the deadline and you need to make a decision. So my concluding remarks is that currently we're in the process of renewing our contracts now that we know what our grant award is, and we've gotten two new sites to be SHEBA sponsors. So currently the unserved areas are Grant, Umatilla, Morrow, and Malheur counties. And I think that within the next 6 months we'll be able to negotiate and find an agency or an entity in one of those communities who will take on this program. During the last 6 months, the three dedicated, the paid-for SHEBA staff, well, we've had customer service staff on board for the limited duration to deal with the phone volume. They've been really hitting rural Oregon. Mr. King's concern and my concern was the isolation that people really feel in rural Oregon, not being able to get information. So I'll say that we went to Pendleton two times during that six-month period and conducted one-day enrollment events. We also trained the staff at the Community Action Agency on how to do the enrollment. We were in Klamath Falls and Lakeview on two different occasions, Heppner, Hermiston, Crook County, the coast, northeast. And when we did these tours, we not only held enrollment events and sent out a press release, but we visited the pharmacies, the senior centers. We tried to figure out where people went for breakfast. We ate a lot. So we could really talk to the people and let them know on the local level that they needed to make a decision. So what's going to happen, I guess, after May 15th? We know we've got about a week left. We don't expect our phones to stop ringing, and I certainly would think it would be remiss if you thought your constituents would stop calling, because I think for a while there will be an increase of calls from people who didn't do anything, who are still needing help trying to find the right thing to do. And what SHEBA, the next phase of what we're going to be dealing with is exceptions and appeals. So, for example, if somebody in August, for example, later this summer, finds out they have a particular medical condition, their doctor says, you can only take this drug, it's the brand name drug, not the generic drug, but it's not on your formulary. There's a process that CMS has built in to the system called the exceptions, and whereby the doctor is the entity that contacts the plan, asks for an exception. that that drug be covered because of medical necessity. However, we know that we're going to be key in brokering some of those relationships. If the plan says no, there's five levels of appeals, starting with appeal directly to the plan is the first level. The fifth and highest level would be on the federal level in federal court. So we'll be involved in helping people with that, as well as ramping up for all the changes on November 15th to the Medicare prescription drug plan and to Medicare in general. By virtue of the Medicare Modernization Act, there will be changes to the Medicare program in general that we'll have to educate ourselves on. So that you know, we have got six people on the phones from 8 to 5. If calls warranted and the volume warranted, and we see that there's calls waiting the next morning, I'll extend staff hours this week. We'll be open from 8 to 4 on Saturday, Sunday if necessary, depending on the call volume on Saturday. And then Monday, which is the last day, we'll be there from 6 a.m. to midnight to help people for the last little bit.
Thank you. Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last time the committee met, we were given some staggering numbers on the increase of seniors that are projected in the state of Oregon. I'm just wondering, and Jane, this question for you too, how prepared are each of you for that kind of increase and its impact on what you're already doing?
Well, I'll answer first. Chair Jensen, Representative Garrard. We are looking for additional funds, and we're doing, I'm sure Mr. King is probably a better person to talk about that as the program administrator, but we're doing everything within our power to look for additional money because volunteers burn out. And volunteers now are working without mileage reimbursements. We have one volunteer coordinator in Douglas County. She drives her volunteers to Reedsport to be able to meet with these people because the price of gas is so high. We have folks in Lakeview calling us, asking us for reams of copy paper because Xeroxing or printing the information on the Medicare.gov website often requires, you know, 20 pages. It's a lot of paper. So I think funding is going to be key, and we're looking at staffing. The good thing is that on the local level, people with regard to the local area agencies on aging and the support that they're able to give at the local level is really augmenting the small amount of support that we're able to give at the state level. So we're doing the best we can within the resource base that we have, but it's a definite issue.
Chairman Jensen, Representative Garrard, it's an interesting question because what we had planned last fall versus what we've been doing for the last 5 months is very different. We thought we had developed a system that would help people as they came in, help them think through their processes, their choices that they had available. And what we found is that it's going to be much more time intensive and much more problem resolution versus choice counseling. So the numbers that you saw last time, I'm assuming that that's from the Department of Human Services, had shown you some of those trends that we're seeing. Many of those people will be coming in with Medicare. We're hoping by that time that they will have already selected a prescription drug plan. So the choice counseling piece may fluctuate and it will still be there, but helping people with their medications will be an ongoing issue that we are now trying to figure out exactly how we will staff that into the future. At this point, we still have six people on a toll-free hotline so that our clients and our local partners can call us and get assistance, including our local pharmacies can call 8 to 5 Monday through Friday. And then I think over time we also need to look around, does it make sense in a public health stance for us to pay for drugs that are off formulary? As an example, does it make sense to pay for a mental health medication because none of the plans are paying for it, but it helps keep that person stable in a low-cost setting or in their own home, which is where they want to be and we want them to be. So I think that's something that we'll be needing to look at as a state is, do we want to help these people with their medications that they can't get through Medicare? And then the ongoing co-payment issues. Do we need to help people make those co-payments so that they don't go without their medications and deteriorate? And that's, I think, across the entire spectrum, not a particular medication or a particular population, but for these very extremely low-income individuals. And I think those are policy decisions that the state will have to make very quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Boone.
Well, it just seems I have a thing in my mouth because my tooth fell out, so bear with me in listening. It seems to me the feds should help with the funding to defray the cost for the volunteers. I mean, the volunteers are providing quite a large piece of assistance to get this through, and since it's a federal program, it seems like that's the least they could do. Maybe that's anecdotal or editorial on my part, but...
Chair Jensen, Representative Boone, you're absolutely correct, and we are in the process of starting some meetings with our congressional delegation, and I think they're working on a funding package that would not only benefit Oregon but the entire national network of ships, because the workload isn't going to go away, and contrary to what we thought maybe 2 years ago about Medicare D, we can see that there's going to be an ongoing need for services, and definitely there should be funding that's commensurate with that responsibility coming from the federal level.
Follow up. Just more of a comment and a thank you for the SHIBA program. I attended a thank you luncheon and awards for SHIBA volunteers and others getting this big project done in our area. Betsy Johnson and we were there for 3 hours, and this room was bigger, three times as big as this, absolutely packed. It had kids from the local high school serving the lunch. All the people popping up and down who were drivers for various programs and everything, and they were all the neighbors and friends helping each other, and there was this big offshoot of other things that happened as they're helping them. They found out this person needs mental health assistance, this person needs in-home care, whatever, and they, it was all coming together, and it was the best feel-good day I've had ever, I think. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to answer Jane Ellen's really not question, but yes, on the mental health coverage. Thank you. We worked hard to get that bill through, and I personally have a deep interest in keeping that. I know it will help in so many ways, so yes, we want to keep it. That's 6 years that I know that I've worked on it. So. Where is SHIBA located? I mean, where's your headquarters, and what is this phone number?
Representative Representative Nelson, our central office is in Salem, Oregon, on 250 Church Street is our address, in Suite 200, and the 800 number, which I should have memorized, and I don't, which is a disgrace on my part, is 800-722-4134.
I guess this is kind of a question for everybody, Ms. Fellow, too, but are all the individuals that we serve, they're all citizens of the U.S.? I mean,
Chairman Jensen, and Chairman Jensen and Representative Nelson, the people that both of our programs are serving, not necessarily just the Medicaid program, but the Medicaid-Medicare project within the Department of Human Services and the SHIBA program, are serving either... I just lost the word. Citizens of the United States and legal residents who have worked enough to qualify for Social Security and Medicare benefits. So they're people who are here legally and who have qualified. You have to have worked at least 10 years within the United States and be covered under the Medicare program.
And is it possible that we could just get a report on how that program runs, this documentation of 10 years of work, and in light of the issue with immigration now, I really appreciate it. I keep getting hit with, we have so many individuals on our plans that we hadn't anticipated it, who are really legitimate American citizens.
Chairman Jensen, Representative Nelson, the determination of the eligibility for the program is actually a federal program, and they determine the eligibility. Social Security Administration actually determines eligibility for Medicare benefits based on someone's work history in the United States, but we will get you some information on that so you can see what the, how they do their program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Annie Mockaby?
Very good. Chair Jensen, members of the committee, I am Annie Mockaby. I'm the Director of Regulatory Affairs for the Regents Group. The Regents Group has Medicare programs, not only covering 60,000 individuals in the state of Oregon, but also in Washington, Utah, and Idaho. For the past 16 years, until very recently, I had accountability for Regents Medicare programs. Over the past 16 years, we've seen an incredible number of changes. We've seen new programs introduced. We've seen rates go up. We've seen rates go down. During the 90s, we saw a number of health plans leave the market. I'm proud to say through all that, Regents has persevered. We are still here. We're not going anywhere. And although nothing could have prepared us for what hit us on January 2nd with Part D, we are convinced that it's getting better. We have benchmarks that daily proclaim that the words are getting out to individuals who need to have them, but our work is not done. Our phone calls have gone from about 1,700 a day to an average of about 700 a day, which seems far more manageable. Since January 1, we have paid out over $32 million in Part D claims. So, yes, we can say that people are getting their prescription drugs and pharmacies are being paid. I would not be one to say there aren't problems. We still don't know exactly who's on our membership list because we still don't have accurate data from CMS. It becomes very challenging when you find that you're paying claims for someone who's on a totally different health plan, but they show up on your list. But we are sorting through the issues, which are primarily, I think, at this point, system issues. A little bit at a time, we seem to be chipping away at the pandemonium. And I'm hopeful that by the time open enrollment in November comes around, we will have recovered from the first 9 months of Part D. That said, there are a number of challenges that the whole industry faces. Big one is that it was estimated that 8 million low-income seniors would be enrolled in Medicare Part D. And to date, there are about 1.8 million enrolled. That leaves us 6 million low-income seniors who are still out there in this country who have not been reached and who are not being able to take advantage of this prescription drug benefit. And I'm very concerned about them. And those are the people who are...
Excuse me a minute. You're talking about, I think, some national figures.
Yes.
For this. Can anyone here talk to me about the Oregon figures?
I left them at the office.
I'll give you time to think about that, and we can get back.
Okay.
Yes, I don't have those figures for Oregon. As I said, I'm still struggling trying to get figures for how many people are actually enrolled in our health plan. But I know that Kaiser Family Foundation recently did a state-by-state analysis of low-income coverage under Part D, and if I can pull those numbers, I will be happy to forward them to the committee. We're concerned about these 6 million people. about the burden that not having coverage places on their families, on our hospitals, on our long-term care facilities, expansion of that cost really has a ripple effect across all of our services. With that said, those people who are enrolled seem to be turning the corner in terms of satisfaction with the benefit. Again, another Kaiser Family Foundation recent poll indicates that the early enrollees would recommend Part D to other seniors by a 6-to-1 margin, and that despite the much-vaulted hassle, enrollees responded 3-to-1 that the time and effort they put into figuring out the program and what program was best for them has actually borne fruit, and they are highly satisfied with the benefit. We continue to face challenges of changing regulations, regulations that are not clear, that we cannot get clear direction from CMS on, and these too are causing issues, I'm sure, for an already confused community. You know, I have worked with the Medicare program for 16 years, and I don't want anybody asking me to explain Part D to them. The regulations that are coming out almost daily that we have never seen before are causing additional administrative costs that we were not prepared for. A key example of that is a 2006 requirement that we staff our telephones 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. This was never part of our budget that we put in place for January 1, yet they're costs that we have to absorb. It's not just having staff on board, it's also having systems people on board and facility people on board. So just in our Oregon operation, we're looking at about 200 people who have had to expand their hours to accommodate these rule changes. It's very difficult to incorporate these kinds of administrative changes, even though as a nonprofit insurer, we can absorb more costs than a for-profit organization can. But at some point, the artificial ceiling on premium costs will start to move. And I think this is something that we should all be very concerned about. CMS has already come out and indicated that the Part A and B medical premiums will be going up again next year. We've seen them go up annually for the past 8 years. And it's critical that we keep this benefit affordable for all of our senior population. And I think that's one of the most frightening things out there. Also, are the attempts to reduce payments to providers. If you talk to medical providers today, you will find that many of them are no longer taking new Medicare patients or beginning to close their practices to Medicare patients. And until we have a stable reimbursement level, we're going to continue to have access challenges, particularly in our rural areas where access is tough to begin with. I don't want to paint a negative picture because I really think that overall this has been a positive 5 months, I look at where we started and where we are today, and we have come a long way. And I think there's a tremendous commitment in the community to make it better. Agencies are coming together to work together. Insurance companies are working together in ways that they have never coordinated on their commercial lines of business, because this really is a great mediator. These are our neighbors and our family members, and for some of us, except of course Chair Jensen, whose birthday will never bring him to Medicare age, we're going to need this benefit for each and every one of us in the coming years. So if I could ask anything from the committee today, from the Oregon legislature, is that we need your help in making sure that this program stays viable, that we can get through the hurdles, that we have programs like SHIBA out there educating our members, getting out to those parts of the community that are difficult to reach, because in order to keep this viable, we all have to be part of it. Thank you.
Annie, we may be a minority, but at least there are a couple of people in the room who are already Part D eligible.
Oh, I find that difficult to believe.
Well, I have a question. I think I heard you say you weren't sure how many people, you don't even know how many people you have on your health insurance. Now, is this Regan saying that? Because if you're paying claims for people who you find out are not even enrolled, how does that explain that trouble those of us who are enrolled have in getting a claim paid?
That's a very good question. Chair Jensen, Representative Boone, we made as soon as we realized, which was probably shortly after the first phone call from Jane Ellen on January 2nd, that the information from the Social Security Administration on low-income subsidized individuals bore very little resemblance to what we saw coming in our eligibility lists. We made the commitment that we would pay claims if someone was on our list, that we would pay claims and we would reconcile later, which is exactly what we have been doing. We are working with our counterparts in other health plans when we call someone and say, oh, this person we've been paying claims for and we just found out that they're on your health plan. The plans are working together to resolve these issues. When I say we don't know how many people are on our health plan, we know exactly how many people are on our list that comes in from CMS that says these are the people that you're responsible for paying claims for. They might also show up on two or three other lists, and that's where we're struggling.
So, follow-up? So does that mean the same doctor, for example, will get three claims or will be paid three times for the same claim?
It could be. That could happen. I've not heard of situations where that's come up, but it could happen.
Chairman Jensen and Representative Boone, what we're hearing more in those circumstances where people are enrolled in multiple plans is a plan pays, and then they get retroactive information from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that says, oh, you should have never paid, and then they've left it up to the plans to call Prescription Pathways or Aetna right. or whoever and say, okay, we paid for Joe Smith $500. Could you give us the $500? Well, yeah, but we paid for Jane Smith $500. So, I mean, it's that kind of negotiation that's going on between the plans. So it's not as if the pharmacies are getting paid multiple times. It's more like it's retroactively all of a sudden the plan finds out that the person, they shouldn't have been paying the claims to that person.
The follow-up?
Quickly.
Okay. So does that mean that who loses that?
Chairman Jensen, Representative Boone, I would say that it's too early to tell. That what happened is when the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services began to discover that we had clients or individuals were enrolled in multiple plans, they actually started sending letters to the individual that said, you're enrolled in two plans or three plans or five or eight, and we need to know which one you want. Call the plan you want. And so that's still all kind of in the wash, and hopefully, I would hope by September that things are resolved. So that the plans are ready for the November open enrollment period to start.
Representative Nelson.
That's good. Thank you
very much. Ms. Mockaby, I was just concerned if this glitch is because we don't have an adequate computer network. I mean, it sounds like it, and I'm...
Chair Jensen, Representative Nelson, I'm not sure the problem is that we don't have an adequate computer network. I think the problem is that we have too many computer networks that don't speak to each other, or at least don't speak to each other in the same language. Until we have a CMS system that can interface with the Social Security Administrative System and the U.S. government retiree system, we're going to live with these glitches. I would like to believe there is an easy fix. I was also responsible for implementing the HIPAA Administrative Simplification Guidelines for the Regents Group. And I can tell you that trying to reconcile systems across the nation so that they're all speaking the same language is a monumental task.
Chairman Jensen and Representative Nelson, just to point out that this is a federal communications mm-hmm. system, right. not state. The state data that the state is responsible to sending to the federal government is actually, we're in the 99th percentile of getting them accurate information. They've got what they need. Thank you. all the credit goes to the systems people at DHS for being able to do that in such tight time frames. But really, there's seven different data transfer points with up to 450 different software vendors that are offering different, because you've got the pharmacy, you've got the insurance plan, you've got the national contractors, you've got the coordination of benefits contractor, you have Social Security Administration, you have the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and you have the states and all the retiree plans and the union plans out there. And so it's everybody trying to talk to each other that's really the breakdown. And so what the plans get is what CMS thinks is accurate, and then when you start working through it is where it really starts to break down.
I'm sure we could spend a lot of time asking questions of you folks, and it probably would be well for us to do that. However, we have a very ambitious agenda for the day, and we're already a little overdue or over our time. With that, I'm apologizing to you all and to the members of the committee, too. I think it's necessary for us to move on. Thank you very much. Appreciate your being here and the testimony you have this morning. And our next item on our agenda is a review of the Oregon swing bed policy and implementation. Our first presentation will be from the Department of Human Services, Cindy Hannon. Oh, and I see we've brought James along today to serve as the spokesman, and Cindy is here to provide the backup for you. Is that, or have I got this incorrect?
Mr. Chairman, something like that.
Okay. Welcome. Please.
James Taves, Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services for Senior and Disability Program, and with me is Cindy Hannum. As a prelude to the swing bed issue, I just wanted to mention something that we discussed with this committee at the last meeting, and Representative Garrard brought up earlier some of the data that we had provided the committee. We are within several weeks of releasing a draft of a long-range plan for the future of long-term care services in Oregon. We'll be on the road for the next month and a half, visiting many communities across the state. The governor sent out a press release several days ago, and we're going to be presenting a tremendous amount of data about the demographic and the aging trends over the next 25 years. And we've actually taken a lot of the current cost data and simply trended that forward based on the population changes to say what would Oregon's system look like if we maintained basically the current mix of services over 25 years, as you nearly double the number of people that will be coming into the retirement years. And the biggest aging cohort that is growing, as we mentioned last time, are those over age 85, which means that the influx of people into long-term care and needing long-term care will become even more dramatic. And Oregon in that period will be one of the oldest states in the country. So we are working very, very hard to sort of pull all this data together to go out to communities. We will also, as part of that, present individual data about individual communities. So in most of your communities, we'll be able to say, based on all the population data and estimates, this is the number of people we're serving in your local community today. This is what we project within 10, 15, 20 years. This is the current service capacity you have today, what it costs, what it would have to look like to accommodate that population in within 25 years, or what changes we'll have to make in long-term care to simply be able to afford all of that. We would also be very pleased if it's this committee committee's wish to come in and do a full briefing for this committee at a future meeting as well, and to present that plan. We've put it on PowerPoint, and so we could put together a pretty comprehensive presentation for you at some later time. But that's an activity that we're very much involved in right now that I know was of much interest to you at the last meeting. Just very quickly in introducing the issue around swing bed, and Cindy in a second will sort of talk about the current state policy, and I know others are here that have concerns about the current state policy. But to put it into context again, Oregon has a long history of very carefully calibrating the mix of long-term care beds versus what we provide in in-home services and community-based care. If you look back historically to the early 80s, Oregon served about 13,000 people in nursing facilities paid under Medicaid. That's now at about 4,800, a very dramatic decline over that period of time. A recent report that came out from AARP actually profiles the states and their spending patterns and lists five states in the country that spend more than 50% of all their long-term care resources in community-based or in-home care as opposed to long-term care beds and institutional kinds of environments. Oregon is actually on top of that heap. We're at about 70% that we expend on the community side. Washington State is a little over 50%, and there's three other states that are between that. So there's only five states that that currently expend most of their dollars on in-home or community-based care. And again, that's fairly dramatic, but when you look at the need for long-term care beds, and in this case swing beds, it's always in the context of what the overall capacity of the system is and how we can support people with fairly complex needs, if need be, in their own homes or in other settings, and that's been a hallmark of Oregon's system. But, of course, the population is growing, our system is becoming stressed, and so we're going to have to rethink a lot of those policies. But that's just a little bit of context as we get into this particular issue.
Mr. Chair, may I?
Representative Delson.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Chair Garrard. Mr. Taves, because I missed last, where do we get this term swing bed? Do you mind to just quickly tell me swing bed? Why do we call it swing bed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'll segue to Ms. Hannum to sort of introduce this topic.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Cindy Hannum, and I am over the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care. Actually work for James, Seniors and People with Disabilities. Swing bed very simply means you can either use a licensed hospital bed to do hospital care, or you can use it to do skilled nursing facility care. And this is actually not a licensure category. Oregon law says we either license hospital beds, and those have to be used primarily for hospital care, acute care. It is a federal designation, and what the federal government says, which is Centers for Medicare Medicaid Services, is that if a rural hospital, and their definition of rural is anything that is not urban by the census. So in Oregon, you can imagine, that's a very large area. And if they have less than 100 beds, then they can obtain federal certification to provide Medicare skilled nursing facility services. Now, what that means, Medicare beneficiaries, and this would be persons 65 or older who are Medicare eligible, or else younger who have received Social Security disability payments for 2 years. Medicare beneficiaries, after receiving a 3-day qualifying hospital stay, can be eligible for post-hospital nursing facility skilled services. And this is a very good benefit. A typical example could be a stroke victim who has gone in for inpatient care, needs to have physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy. You could have a broken leg that needs to have rehab services. But the distinction here is this is not long-term care, custodial care. Medicare does not pay for long-term care. So this is definitely a post-hospital skilled nursing rehab benefit. There's a variety of skill procedures that might be involved. I don't think I need to go into that. But these are people who are not medically stable, have not reached a chronic stage where they could go out into regular long-term care. Now, we have a variety of hospitals. Many rural hospitals here in Oregon have that federal Medicare swing bed status. What we have done as a state Medicaid agency is we have paralleled that. What we have said, is, and this dates back to the late 80s, early 90s, that we recognize that post-hospital care is a very valuable service. There are people who do not qualify for Medicare who are Medicaid beneficiaries. So we are willing to pay if they qualify under our eligibility for a comparable complex add-on Medicaid rate. But again, we're talking skilled. This has always been our policy in Oregon. Skilled nursing facility services, which are usually limited because people get better. We have not provided swing bed status for long-term care beds. Now, the reason we haven't done that, and it varies nationally. There are states that do. There are states that only restrict it to skilled services such as we do. There are states who don't provide swing bed services at all. But why we did it is because of the very thing James was talking about, that in this state we have heavily emphasized since our first waivers that we are developing community-based care options. We don't want to see people living in nursing facilities who absolutely do not need to. So this has all been in sync with our regular philosophy. Now, I have attached, do you all have copies? This is our current Medicaid swing bed rule, and I'll walk through it with you. First of all, you've got to be certified to also receive Medicare
from, and this says HCFA, but it's actually now Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So we are not doing this unless facilities are also participating in the Medicare swing bed program. They have to have a Medicaid provider number. We have only been doing this for 5 residents at a time, and the reason for this is this has been sufficient to provide that skilled service for non-Medicare beneficiaries. And I should clarify one thing here for you. Medicare, as a benefit package, pays up to 20 days full payment for skilled nursing facility care, and then up to 80 days co-payment, meaning that the beneficiary has to come up with the money themselves. We will also pay for a Medicaid beneficiary that co-payment period. So we'll either do it as a companion to the co-payment for Medicare, or for people who are not Medicare eligible or continue past the Medicare time frame to have the skilled nursing and rehab needs, we will pay the Medicaid payment, limiting it up to 5 residents. That's the number of beds. We also do not want to provide this benefit if there are other licensed nursing facilities within a 30-mile radius. This only makes sense. This would be direct competition with licensed nursing facilities. So, and then the payment rate is in accordance with our regular structure. Now, there are many hospitals who have both Medicare, Medicaid swing bed status. Some of these hospitals also have skilled nursing facilities attached. So they're primarily using the skilled, but if at any time they are full, they can go over to the swing bed status. Our concern here is twofold. Just to summarize for you. One, we think that there has to be a certain amount of beds that are kept open for hospital care at all time. And our recommendation from the department at this time is that be at least 5 beds or twice the average daily census of the hospital, whichever is greater. State law speaks to the fact that hospitals need to primarily provide hospital care. The federal government allows hospitals who have swing bed status to have all beds be used either way. So they don't make that same type of distinction, is my understanding. But we, under Oregon law, believe that we need to. Number two, we are still very concerned about having swing bed status for long-term care. We would consider an exceptional policy for an individual community that is a sole source type provider that has no capacity whatsoever, and we believe, and our information shows, there are people who need nursing facility care, long-term care, who there are not sufficient resources within that area. But we would prefer to do that on a waiver or an exception basis rather than have a broad change in state policy, because again, we believe that even in rural Oregon, most communities have the capacity through their community-based care systems and available nursing facility beds to do long-term care in that manner. And I would be happy to answer any questions for you.
Good question.
I just, Mr. Chair, I'm just, when you're talking about this, thank you very much. Cindy, how many, did we talk about how many people qualify in the state now for this type of program?
For the current Medicaid swing bed, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I do not have that exact figure. Julia Huddleston, do you, off the top, we can get that for you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Can I just ask one more quick question, please?
Quick?
Yes, thank you. When we talk about rehab, does this also include drugs?
Representative Jensen, Representative Nelson, rehab refers to therapies that are provided, such as physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy. Drugs would be medication that is provided. It's not used in the same way. Therapies would be a therapist actually working with someone.
But not recovering from being a drug addict or?
No.
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 Do you have something else, Jen?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let's see. At this point, we have the Oregon Hospital Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, Victor Banda, he was the CEO at Pioneer Memorial Hospital. And, Oregon Healthcare Association, Mr. Jim Carlson, the executive director. And then I think Michael Bell, with a firm that does accounting or auditing for, among other clients, I'm sure, but some hospitals, and we're all here.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the task force. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I have about 2.5 hours of testimony for you on swing beds. Actually, most of what I've learned about swing beds I've learned this morning. I appreciate your interest in opening up this issue. My purpose here is just to introduce both Mike Bell and Victor Vanderdoes, who know much more about the subject, generally its policy and financial implications, and the community implications, particularly in rural communities like Heppner, where Victor is from. And we do appreciate your interest in this topic and willingness to explore some of the options that may be available to the state. I think Ms. Hannum explained well what state policy has been for a number of years, but that's having consequences, particularly in some communities that we think it's appropriate for the legislature to reconsider. So with that, I'd like to ask Mike to start, then Victor can talk, and hopefully Jim will start talking about noon. And we'll all be able to leave.
At 12 o'clock. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Mike. Then we've got Victor.
Mike Bell.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here today. My name is Mike Bell. I'm a CPA. I work exclusively with healthcare organizations. Last year I worked at about 60 hospitals. Most were critical access. Most of the facilities I work with are very similar to Pioneer Memorial and Heffner. And I work primarily on reimbursement and accounting matters. I'd like to at this time maybe just go through some notes that I have concerning the swing bed program, and that may answer some questions. Representative Nelson asked a good question earlier. What is a swing bed? I usually tell people that ask that question, imagine a tree with this canvas sort of tied between the two trees, and that would be a swing bed. But it's just to give a little humor here. It's
in other words.
Correct. And for some people that live along I-5, that might be believable. But you know, out in eastern Oregon, they would laugh at that and move on. But a swing bed is actually, the term swing means that the facility can swing the use of that bed to meet the needs of the community. A swing bed is a bed that's located in an acute care hospital, and it can be used for three things as defined by the federal government, and three things as defined by almost every state in the union except Oregon. Those three things are acute care services, which are traditional hospital services, skilled nursing home care, which is a very high acuity level of nursing home care, and then traditional nursing home care or intermediate care. So in every state in the union that I work, and I work with eight states, I don't work with everybody, but in the eight states I work with other than Oregon, you can use a swing bed for any one of those things, and it's up to the hospital to decide what the needs of the communities are. Today it can be an acute care hospital bed, Tomorrow it can be a skilled nursing home patient in that bed. The following day it could be an intermediate care or traditional nursing home patient in that bed.
Are you implying that that community can figure out what its needs are as well as we can figure them out at this IFC here?
Well, they seem to think so, Representative Jensen.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, please.
Thank you. I'm just curious, what happens when you have acute care and your facilities are already being used by not acute needed?
Well, typically...
I mean, how do these places change quickly? Kick one out and turn them over in the hammock and put another one in?
Well, that's a very good question. In other states, typically what happens is a critical access hospital, which is defined as a small rural hospital with no more than 25 beds set up in the hospital itself. In other states, all 25 beds are swing beds. And the hospital traditionally will set aside certain number of beds, 4 or 5 beds if that's what the demand is, and they will leave those available just for hospital care.
Empty.
If there's no need for hospital care, they will keep those beds set aside. Now, there are a couple reasons why. One, as you alluded to, it's to make sure that you meet the community demand. But the other is that you get paid here in the state of Oregon about $140 a day for traditional nursing home care. And for an acute care patient, you're going to get paid over $1,000 a day.
Right.
So it would be foolish for a hospital to use all of its beds for a patient that only pay $140 a day and turn away the hospital patients that are paying over $1,000 a day. Small rural hospitals, and it's not to suggest that they provide care based on payment, but they need to make sure that they capture the resources that they can to provide all the care they can. So traditionally, when we see a facility with 25 beds within the hospital services, and they're all certified as swing bed, they'll set aside a minimum of 4 or 5, some of them as many as 10, depending on how many acute care patients are averaging per day. They may set aside another 2 or 3 for skilled care, the skill level of care. And then they realize that they've got empty beds, 10, 15, sometimes as many as 20, that are not used by anybody for anything, and they fill those beds up with long-term care patients, traditional nursing home care patients. And I guess I would argue, too, that if you've got a nursing staff that's capable of treating acute care patients, and they're capable of treating skilled nursing home care patients, they certainly can provide long-term care. And in many cases, that's exactly what the facility has done traditionally. In fact, in other states, we have one hospital that I can think of that's a very easy example. They had one nursing home wing. It had 25 beds on that wing. The first 5 beds were hospital beds. The other 20 beds were long-term care nursing home beds. And they went to their state and said, we'd like to make all 25 of these hospital beds and certify them all as swing. And the state said, no problem. We're going to move the imaginary line down the hall, and now all of those beds are nursing hospital beds certified for the 3 uses. And we'll allow you the flexibility. The 2 changes occurred. Well, 3 changes. The imaginary line moved down the hall. The nursing home patients that were in those 20 beds now become swing bed patients. They didn't notice that anything else had changed. Same staff, same bed, same everything. And the only other thing that changed was that the hospital was now not incurring significant losses on nursing home care. And I'll get into that in just a moment. But the importance of swing beds is it provides the hospital with the maximum use of its beds, and they define that locally. It allows the hospital to meet the needs of the community locally as much as possible. And it eliminates the significant financial losses that the hospitals are incurring on the nursing home care that they currently provide. Currently, it's not unusual for a small rural hospital that provides nursing home care to have a cost per day of $180 a day, and the payments from the state are $140 a day, and they're required to subsidize the nursing home at the tune of $14,600 per patient per year. That is a cost that small rural hospitals cannot absorb, and I'm afraid what we're going to see is our situation similar to what we saw at Pioneer Memorial in Heppner, where the nursing home is closed because the hospital can't afford to pay $14,000 per patient per year to keep the nursing home open. Once a nursing home bed is converted to a swing bed, that loss is significantly reduced. In the example I have here, the loss would be reduced from $14,800 a day to $2,900 per patient. $2,900 they can afford, $14,600 they can't. The way that happens is this, and the example I gave, the cost was $180 a day. The Medicaid payment was $140 a day. There's $40 of unreimbursed cost, and that's where they're losing. That's $40 for every patient for every day. There are a couple solutions. One solution is the state could pay $180 a day, and that would eliminate the problem. But traditionally, most states aren't willing to do that. You've got limited resources, so that solution is probably not a good one. The other solution is this, that if you make the nursing home part of the facility, part of the hospital, in other words, take the nursing home facility, move it under the hospital licensure and make those beds swing beds, then what happens is this, that you've got now, you don't have an acute care facility and a nursing home facility, you've got a swing bed facility in the eyes of the federal and state government. And the federal and state government now estimate the cost of providing the nursing home care at the amount the state's willing to pay. So the federal government would then indicate in that example, with everything under the hospital's license, that for every traditional nursing home patient day you provided, your cost is $140 a day, not $180. Well, what happened to that extra $40 a day? That extra $40 a day is now considered an acute care cost, part of acute care services. Medicare uses 75% of the acute care services, and they pay cost. So they're going to pay 75% of that $40. The state uses about 5% of the hospital services, acute care services, and they pay costs. So they're going to pay about 5% of that $40. So about $32 of that $40 get paid for through acute care reimbursement, hospital Medicare reimbursement, hospital Medicaid reimbursement. And the loss is reduced significantly. So by allowing the facility to move the imaginary line down the hall and change the name from hospital to swing bed, the loss suddenly just disappears or is substantially reduced. Here in this state, the problems you run into with this scenario is that, one, the state does not define swing bed as acute, skilled, and intermediate care. It says it's only acute and skilled. And in fact, we were given a figure from the Office of Healthcare Policy and Research. And in 2004, in the state of Oregon, there were 10,359 swing bed days provided. Of those days, the state determined that the medical add-on eligibility, the skilled Medicaid patients that they permitted, were 102. 102 days the state allowed Medicaid patients to be in a swing bed out of 10,359 total swing bed days provided. That perhaps demonstrates the restrictive nature of the use of swing beds here in the state of Oregon. I also, in the previous presentation, had mentioned that some states also limit the swing bed use to just acute care and skilled. I'd like to know what other states do that. I'm not aware of any. There may be another one out there, but I'm not aware of any. Every state that I work with defines it as being any of those three. Use it, don't use it. I mean, if it requires a bed in any of those settings, the local facility gets to decide that they can use it. One of the questions might be, what does it cost the state to have a patient in a swing bed versus a nursing home bed? And the answer is it doesn't cost them anything because they essentially pay the same rate for both care. If they're paying $135 a day in a traditional nursing home, they're going to pay about $135 a day in a swing bed. So there's no difference as far as what the state's going to pay. The state mentioned that we have some concerns about the fact that patients may be getting into a swing bed that perhaps would not be eligible in a nursing home setting. That's really a misnomer, too. In every state that we work in, if you're not eligible to get into a nursing home bed under state Medicaid regulations, you're not permitted to get into a swing bed as a Medicaid patient. They use the same criteria, the same admission criteria. So there is no opportunity there for a patient that's not eligible for traditional nursing home care in a nursing home bed to somehow get into a swing bed and get the state to pay for it. I've never run into that situation because the criteria is the same. So the criteria is the same, the payments are the same. They're receiving care in a facility that's licensed to provide acute care and skilled care, and yet because of the rules that we live under at this time, traditional nursing home care is not available. The state regulations, in my opinion, this is OAR 411-070-0130 is the one that governs swing bed use, and it clearly indicates that that those beds can only be used for skilled care. We would ask that the legislature expand that definition and allow swing beds to be used for traditional nursing home care or intermediate care. That same regulation limits the number of Medicaid patients that can be in a swing bed to 5. I'm not sure why, if it's reasonable and necessary care for one patient or 5 patients, why couldn't it be 10 patients or 15 or whatever the local community feels they need? But the limit to 5 Medicaid patients in any one facility at any one time seems to be rather arbitrary, and I don't think there's a real need for that. In other states, we find that hospitals that have been certified by Medicare as Medicare critical access hospitals, they're allowed to have up to 25 beds. They're allowed to certify all of those beds as swing beds. And this is not to say they're going to use all of those 25 beds for long-term traditional nursing home patients. It just says that they've got 25 beds and they can use them for any purpose within that definition of those three types of services that they so choose. Other states have also indicated that if you're a hospital and you're currently licensed, in the example I gave earlier, for 5 hospital beds, and you've got 20 nursing home beds, that you can, without going to certificate of need, without going through construction review, without any unnecessary complications, move the imaginary line down the hall and allow those 20 nursing home beds to now become swing beds, to eliminate the financial loss and allow the maximum flexibility. And we would encourage the state to consider that opportunity also. So with that, I guess I'll end my...
Wait, did you want to ask your questions now, or did you want to hear that?
I'd just as soon ask now.
Okay.
I may think of something else later. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bell, sounds like you've got a magic beanstalk here that will produce money from nowhere, and I'd like to probe a little more on where the money to make up this loss is actually coming from. Doesn't it assume if you increase the number of swing beds and allow, you described it as the loss magically goes away, doesn't that assume that there's another patient essentially covering the cost of the $40 loss on another bed?
In small rural facilities, let me see if I can explain. In small rural facilities, acute care services are used predominantly by Medicare. So 75% of the acute care services in a hospital are purchased by Medicare, about 5% by Medicaid, the other 20% right. by other payers. When Medicare and Medicaid pay on a cost basis,
right.
The other payers do not pay on a cost basis. They pay based on charges or whatever the insurance company has negotiated with the hospital. So basically what we've got is we've got nursing home unreimbursed cost of, in the example, $40 a day being grouped now or identified as an acute care cost because now we've combined those two into one. They remove the cost of the nursing home care using the statewide rate, $140 a day, whatever's left, they spread that cost over the acute care patients. Since Medicare uses almost all of the services, or 75% of the services, that $40 is an additional cost in the acute care side, and Medicare pays 75% of it. So Medicare will pay more. The Medicare patient will not pay more because the deductible that the Medicare patient pays is a once annual payment that doesn't change based on cost. So the Medicare patient's deductible won't change, coinsurance won't change, Medicaid patient doesn't pay anything like that, so that doesn't change. So almost all of that loss, that $14,600 a year that's reduced down to $2,900 a year, so about $11,000 becomes an acute care cost. Medicare pays 75% of it. Medicaid pays 5% of it. The patients don't pay any more of it at all. And
well, the patient may not pay out of, if I may, Mr. Chair, follow up. The patient may not pay out of pocket, but someone is paying on the patient's behalf, and that someone, I think, are the people sitting in this room who pay federal Medicare taxes. Am I missing something there?
No, Medicare would pay more.
Right. That's where I'm trying to simplify it.
Right.
If there's a loss now and the hospital reduces its loss by $11,000, someone has to give the hospital $11,000.
Right. That's very true.
And what I'm trying to understand is if the cost for nursing home care is actually $180, but what you're saying is that the federal regulations, if we change the Oregon regulations, would allow some of the costs that actually belong on this bed to be moved over to this bed, even though the person in that bed isn't getting those services.
That's correct.
Okay, thanks.
May I just add one more thing, if I may? The alternative, the corrective action plan that I mentioned originally, was to have the state pay for the cost of nursing home care at $180 a day, and that would be an acceptable solution. But I don't recommend that. I don't recommend that the state pay anything that we can get the federal government to pay.
Well, that's all good and well, sir, but we also all pay taxes to the federal government. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll save on that. We'll come back to it. Representative Bright.
I think my question was Representative Nolan asked me.
Well, then let's briefly, very briefly, talk about that. It is a Medicare is picking up at least the bulk of this cost shift, if you will.
And I'm not making judgment on that yet, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to understand it.
Yeah, no, I understand that, Representative. However, as we consider our judgments on that, we probably want to recognize that if most or many states are currently doing this, that means that our Medicare dollars that we're paying, you and I are paying, are being exported to Washington, the state of. Is that correct?
Oh, and the different Medicare reimbursement rates among the states.
Well, I understand that.
Another whole scene
that this committee is not prepared to get into right now. Maybe at another time we will.
Rattle that cage.
Okay. I appreciate your question, though, and certainly there's nothing in this world that comes about for free. I mean, that's, if it is, be careful how quickly you accept that. But, let's go on because we still want to keep ourselves on task here. Victor.
Thank you. My name is Victor Vanderduis. I'm the administrator of Moore County Health District. Mm-hmm. The health district operates the Pioneer Memorial Hospital in Heppner. We also operate two primary clinics, one in Irrigan and one in Heppner. We subsidize a third clinic, an FQHC, or a Frederick Clark Health Clinic in Boardman. We operate the entire ambulance service for the entire county. We have a home health and hospice. And we also manage a small 16-unit assisted living in HEP. So we do have a few things going on. I think what I'll do is answer some of the questions that have already been asked. One of the questions is, are there enough beds for us to swing to keep acute care whole? I've been there 6 years, and our average length of stay for a patient is probably less than one, certainly less than two. Two patients per day in the hospital. We have a 12-bed hospital. We have a lot of flexibility. Last December, I believe we had eight patients. That was for us, and even in a 12-bed, that's full. Consider male, female, potential infections, those kinds of things. I think there were a couple swing bed patients in the facility at that time. I think what we're looking at is having the feds pay the difference. There are one more option that Mike didn't mention. One is the state pays full reimbursement or full cost, have the feds pick up the difference, or we close. That's what we did. We closed. We closed our nursing home back in before 2003. We had to close because the pro-share money, what you call upper limits or MUPL money, went away. We were getting around $200,000 to $250,000. That subsidized the nursing home portion of it. When we closed, we had 12 residents in a 20-unit facility. And in the beginning, when it was first built, it was 30 units. We downsized in the late 90s, and then put it all on one floor, and then by the time we closed, because we weren't recruiting, because we knew MUPL was going away, we got it down to 12 residents. Those 12 residents had to go someplace else. The nearest facility is a little less than 50 miles away in Hermiston. Three residents we managed to put in a assisted living that had just newly opened up in and around that time. We managed to squeak those in under, it was a difficult push for assisted living, moving from a nursing home, but they managed to come out well. The other ones we gingerly moved to other facilities, some in Portland, some in Pendleton, some in Hermiston. Three or four of the residents died in the transition.
Died in what?
In the transition, in the move. That's pretty common when you've been in a facility for a long time, a resident, and you do whatever you can to make that transition go smoothly. We couldn't afford any longer to subsidize that much money. Actually, Mike was talking about $40 difference. Actually, it turned out to be more like $80 a day difference for us. So it was very, very difficult to subsidize. We couldn't ask the voters to pay for 12 residents additional taxes. We since then have had to go back to the voters to ask for additional monies just to maintain the ambulance services because nothing pays great. I mean, we're a critical access. We get paid costs. This has been a fairly good year because business has been good, better than usual, but for the most part, that's unusual for a small community. We have to subsidize everything. We even subsidize your Medicare Part D sign-up. Excuse me, not yours, but the federal government's Part D. We felt as a district that it was too complex for a resident, a Medicare patient, to sign up. It was next to impossible. It was difficult for us. So we studied, we learned, and then we went to the four high schools in the county, set up programs in their computer rooms, and signed people up. And then we signed them up in the hospital, and we continue to do that. We've signed up about 250 folks, including our board chair. Not unusual. I mean, the children of these Medicare residents come in. It's too complex for them to sign up, so we help them. That has worked out real well. Certainly good PR for the for us in the community. That's what we do besides just acute care. That's the kinds of things. We do other things like we've just authorized putting AEDs, defibrillators, in the high schools because we had a young person drop on the court, a coach in Boardman, not that long ago. And because of the defibrillator that happened to be close by, saved that person's life. We love to do things that make a lot of money. We certainly don't do those things. We like doing things that make a little money, and we like doing things that at least break even because we need to do these other outreach things for our community. A swing bed program like that, we'd probably use no more than 10 additional beds in our facility. That's the way our facility is set up. And maybe only 5 of them would be occupied. We wouldn't have to transport our residents out of community. It's, with the price of fuels, low-income people, it's hard for them to get to Hermiston or Pendleton to see their parents or loved ones. Extremely difficult. Yeah, this is about money, certainly, and it's about the feds cleaning up and paying a little bit more, but it's also a community service. It's important to the community to have these people. It was very, very, very difficult to close a nursing home. Big meeting, I got up and had to take all the hits for everything, but truth is a small community sometimes can't afford to do that without additional help, and it's cost-based help. Critical access is talking about cost-based. Again, yes, absolutely. Medicare is going to pay the difference, and we all pay for that. But we all pay for a lot of things that we shouldn't be paying for now. I certainly don't say that we shouldn't be paying for this, though. This is certainly one of the better programs. And I'm originally from Washington State, so I know that system works. And then the other states around us, that system works. I'm pleased to hear that the state is willing to look at, certainly individual waivers. I'm not excited about individual waivers. We probably certainly do that, and I'll probably have the letter in the mail for a waiver next week when I get back. But, you know, there are other hospitals in our area. I know I talked to the administrator in Baker City. He's interested in, because he has a nursing home attached, and he's bleeding money. I know the facility in Enterprise is losing lots of money from their nursing home facility, and that they could potentially use this as assistance for that, for community. So there's lots of different ways we can help rural communities. Critical access has been a lifesaver. We wouldn't be there today if it wasn't for critical access and being able to reorganize how we do things. That has helped a lot. Critical access, basically federal government payment system that permits beds of, it used to be 15 or less, now it's 25 or less, that gets cost-based reimbursement. Or actually now it's 101% of cost. Obviously cost is good. We don't expect to make lots of money. Critical access hospitals don't make lots of money. They don't make very small, they hardly make any significant margins at all. But if we can cover our costs, that's what a community certainly needs to do. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you very much. Thank you for being here, gentlemen. We just keep talking about rural areas. Why isn't this viable everywhere?
Perhaps I could offer an answer, and Victor, too. But in larger communities, in the urban areas or even the larger rural areas, I think you've got the volumes, you've got the population that would support or provide the number of patients you need to operate a viable nursing home. Traditionally, for-profit organizations that operate nursing homes would not operate a nursing home unless it had 75 beds or more. In fact, these days it's more like 125 beds. So if you're in a community that cannot operate a nursing home that needs to have at least 75 or 125 beds, then you're going to be operating a facility that's going to lose money. Break even basically is having that number of beds and having those beds filled. So I think in large urban areas, you can operate a nursing home with the state payment that you get, and you can make money at it. Not a lot of money, but enough money to cover your cost and have something left over. In smaller communities, rural communities, there's usually not the population base that would allow a nursing home of that size to be operated. Victor mentioned you were averaging 12 when you closed.
There were 12 residents. It's basically about cost shifting for an urban area. Volumes obviously make up a significant difference, and then private pays will get the cost shifted to them.
Well, if I just follow up, Mike.
Follow up, and let me. I think basically what we're talking about in Morrow County and some of the other places mentioned is that. That as it is now, the community is unable to offer a nursing home facility in Heppner. There are no nursing homes there.
Okay.
The reason there are none there is because they didn't have that N that's needed to provide a viable nursing home there. This contrasts to the urban areas where we have considerably more service-oriented facilities, be they private or, for that matter, even be they public, than sometimes we have in the rural areas. So I think I'm not stating this incorrectly from your position, and that's that's the issue we're really, I think, looking at here, part of the issue that we're looking at.
Well, follow up, please. Yes, I'm afraid to misunderstand this, and I'll get with any of you later, or with some of you. But, for example, I don't know what I live in Yamhill County. I have a wonderful hospital,
number one in the nation in McMinnville. But when you have all these rural, you know, 11 rural cities, we're talking about people who can't drive. We're talking about helping those that are very low income. I mean, we have two, maybe three little income centers in my whole county, but all these other smaller towns. So when it comes, for example, Sheridan, Oregon, which is, you know, outside 20, 30 miles away, they still need to have this opportunity somehow, even though it's a great hospital, but there aren't that many with income to pay their way. How do we know which hospitals get to qualify?
Well, let me offer an answer, if I may. We would strongly recommend that any change in the regulations would allow or be limited to Medicare-certified critical access hospitals. And as Victor mentioned, those are small rural hospitals that are certified to operate no more than 25 acute care beds, including swing beds. And that's what we would suggest, and then it would limit changes to just those communities that we feel would benefit from this change, and would exclude any larger communities from participating in this, simply because they may not be looking at meeting the needs of the community as much as taking advantage of an opportunity that you all may not have identified at the time yet.
The majority of the critical access hospitals, there's 25 of them in the state. The majority of them are either on the coast or on the east side. There are
how many are there?
25 total. Many of them on the east side, but there's an equal amount along the coast. Again, less than 25 beds is the criteria. And most of the hospitals that are 25 beds or less probably have converted if they haven't by now, because it's just to their advantage certainly to do that.
Mr. Chairman,
if I may add that really what we're talking about is a hospital survival strategy for our small rural hospitals, figuring out as many ways as possible to help districts and hospitals like Victor's keep their doors open. Many communities don't have hospitals locally available to them. That's a problem too. We're trying to make sure that those who still do don't lose those hospitals that are already serving their communities. And Heppner is a good example of a fragile hospital.
Heppner's a new hospital.
About 46 to 49 miles to good
and
good Shepherd.
In January and February, can you comment on the quality of the roads between?
I have a very good example. In sometime in December, there was a good ice storm, and our northern ambulance facility had 46 runs in that one day. Just people were falling off the roads on a regular basis, and these are volunteers too. So it does take a lot. Yes, on occasion I'll drive ambulance too as a backup. So it does get a little interesting to make transfers, you know, because most of the patients that are serious do get transferred either air-lifed, and if it's really bad weather, then we have to drive.
Representative Greif,
this is along those same lines, but you're not particularly associated with swing beds, but. Do you run your own ambulance service?
Yes.
Do you make money?
I think we pretty much get close to break even because we are critical access. If we weren't critical access, or an independent or a fire department would run it, they'd be on fee schedule and they wouldn't make money. They'd have to subsidize it. I think we're pretty close to within a few thousand dollars of breaking even, only because we're critical access and it's a hospital based ambulance service, even though, you know, two of the ambulances or four of them are, you know, 40 some miles away.
Well, our hospital in Klamath tried running an ambulance service and make money and couldn't do it. Now the fire district does it. But I'm already hearing from people that ambulance service is going to be one of the next critical areas in rural Oregon, that we're going to start losing ambulance service. So that's why I'm curious as to whether you can make money with it, because it looks to me like it's very difficult.
I don't think it's ever been about necessarily making money. I mean, you got to try to get as close to break even. The community has to subsidize it somehow in rural areas. I don't think yours is a critical access hospital. That's why the difference is the fee schedule doesn't pay enough. It just doesn't. You know, we're probably in the middle of the fee schedule. You know, we don't, not too high, not too low. Very difficult. EMS, it's about staff, about the regulations to get EMTs trained. So it's about staffing as well as just buying an ambulance too. Volunteers are getting tired. You know, in any small community, there's only so many people that continually volunteer for just about everything, and they're just getting tired of doing that.
And we keep getting older.
Yeah, that doesn't help either.
I would add too that the district probably doesn't make money on anything that it offers. The community is very kind and generous and provides tax subsidies that are sufficient to help out the ambulance service and the hospital and the clinics and the other services provided. The other thing I would mention too with ambulance, even as a critical access hospital, the only reason Victor's ambulance service gets paid cost is because they're more than 35 miles from the next nearest ambulance service. There are a lot of critical access hospitals out there that are subsidizing their ambulance service heavily because they don't get paid cost. They're getting paid fee scale because there's another ambulance service within 35 miles of their hospital. And that ambulance service doesn't even have to provide services to that community. It just has to be within that 35-mile range, and the federal government cuts off cost-based reimbursement. Recently, I was talking with somebody from CMS, Medicare, and they said, we think critical access hospitals are making a profit on Medicare. And I said, you're paying cost. How do I make money when I'm paid cost? If I build a house and you pay me the cost of the materials, how do I make money on that? Even if you pay me for my time, how do I make money on that? It's not something, if you're only getting paid cost, there's no profit margin included. The best you can hope for is break even, and even that doesn't happen. With not allowable services and denials and things like that, even the hospitals that are getting 101% of cost, we figure they're only really getting about 95% of the cost of the services provided to Medicare.
Our local taxpayers subsidize us with two different kinds of levies, a base levy around 60 cents per thousand, which is about 10% of our full budget, and another special levy that we pass, 39 cents per thousand. So it's about 14% total. The three-year levy will, you know, end in a couple years. We'll either have to go back to the voters, or hopefully, if we keep our fingers crossed, this NASTAR track comes in Boardman, and, you know, $400 million on the tax rolls, or maybe a billion by time it's, you know, you never know, would help us a lot, too.
This discussion would be kind of
tax deferral.
Right.
the demand for the services could go up astronomically, so
that's
another problem.
That's true.
And this time for a comment on something that's come up lately too for EMS services, and that this one size fits all. This is terrible, I know. Sorry. But
that's terrible. There's nothing wrong. You're just hard to understand.
Yeah. Well, but the state is in the trying to require more and more training. And it's one thing if people are paid for it, but you're talking about volunteers, fire departments, and ambulance service, but it's mostly for EMS. And it really makes a difference between you guys on the east side and maybe where I am. And, hey, they may need 2 hours to get to you and get you to your treatment. But in our area, if it took 2 hours, you're dead. That means the helicopter's not flying. It means no ambulance is running, or you can't drive, because we're always within a half hour to 45 minutes of at least Astoria Hospital in our area. And if you can't go there and you go to Portland, it's an hour, so you're still okay there. But you're going to see people in these volunteer fire departments dropping like flies. We're down to 5 people out of 15 normal in our fire department, and a lot of it's because you drill once a week, at 2 to 3 hours. Then there's EMS training once a week for 2 to 3 hours, and if you're doing beyond first responder level, you're talking about 3 hours twice a week for 10 weeks, and sometimes 6 months, depending on the level. And then there's the weekend, all weekend, starting Friday night, all day Saturday, most of the day Sunday. And these are just to keep your certification level up, and they're talking about increasing that. So, I mean, these are people who have families and jobs and lives other than that. And this doesn't even start to address what he was talking about. You've got 46 runs, so you're out on call. So your time is being spent like that. Pretty soon these people go, that's enough. You know, that's enough, and they quit. So there.
Do we know how you feel about
that? Yeah, I was going to say, so that's how I feel about it.
Okay. Jim.
No problem. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Carlson, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. We're a private, not-for-profit trade association representing about 550 licensed long-term care providers, including about 85% of the nursing facilities in the state. I think what you've heard a good description of is the challenges that we have maintaining access to essential health care services throughout rural Oregon, rural communities, rural hospitals, nursing facilities, other ambulance services, the whole range of services. I think that you've really got a couple of issues here. If you're going to look at trying to come up with a fix to address some of these concerns, you've got a couple issues you have to look at. And, you know, some of it gets into in terms on how narrow maybe an exception process that would be carved out would be, gets into resource allocation decisions. You know, getting back to the question Representative Nolan asked on the magic beanstalk, yeah, the magic beanstalk is the taxpayer. Your average nursing facility in the state has almost 70% of its total revenue comes from Medicaid. The next largest payer source is Medicare, and then after that, private pay, consumers, and individuals. And so I think actually it took a panel of hospital industry representatives to do a really good job of testifying to you on how difficult it is to keep a nursing facility viable with the resources that are paid to fund services. And I think particularly when you look at the federal level on the Medicare program, Medicare has historically been willing to invest a lot more money to provide that care in a hospital-based setting as opposed to in a freestanding community nursing facility. There's really a couple things you're looking at. One is a statutory issue. The definition of hospital in the state, and I think you all have a memo, at least I saw a memo that was done up by legislative counsel for Chair Jensen, that talks about the definition of hospital. The beds have to be primarily available for hospital patients, and so if you were to designate all 25 beds of a 25-bed hospital, you would be running afoul of the definition of hospital under Oregon law, according to legislative counsel. So first and foremost, you've got a statutory problem or issue that needs to be addressed on the definition of hospital that potentially could be changed to maybe carve out an exemption for certain circumstances. The second issue you've got is really a payment limitation on that's an administrative rule under the Senior and People with Disabilities Division. And really what that payment limitation does, and I don't know, I believe Ms. Hannum, Mr. Taves gave you a copy of that. What that really does is that restricts the number of beds a hospital receiving the medical add-on payment for Medicaid services under this rule may receive on Medicaid payment to no more than a total of 5 residents at one time. And so that's an administrative rule issue that was basically in there designed to try to manage the exposure to costs. Generally speaking, if you had in a community and you have many critical access hospital communities where you do have freestanding community nursing facilities available, if you're going to provide the service in the community nursing facility on a freestanding basis under Medicaid versus in a hospital swing bed where you're paying the complex medical add-on rate, the current rate differential would be actually more the difference between about $165 per day roughly in the freestanding facility in the community versus around $235, $240 a day in the hospital-based setting. And I think the reason why the state Medicaid agency would prefer to provide it in the lower cost setting there is both from a resource allocation standpoint, but also if you're trying to maintain the financial viability also of that nursing facility in those communities and some of those rural communities where you do have nursing facilities, I think you're trying to strike that balance, maintaining a hospital and a nursing facility, so you don't end up with situations like they've experienced in Heppner and some other communities where they've been forced to see the nursing facility close. I think if you addressed a fairly narrow exception in the hospital definition first, statutorily, and then a second one in the payment limitation issue, I think you could fix this. In order for our organization to support that, we would want to see a more narrow exception than communities with critical access hospitals. You've got 25 communities with critical access hospitals. About 20 of those actually do have community nursing facilities in them. Okay, and so you don't want to do something that's going to destabilize and threaten the viability of those community nursing facilities. But when you get into Heppner, Harney County, Lake County, Wallowa County, and I think John Day Prairie City, I think's the fifth, at least, on a fairly quick review of these, at least in those five areas, you could carve out an exemption for what I'd call a sole provider of those services, both from the payment limitation rule on the Medicaid side, as well as also on the hospital definition that would allow them to designate 100% of their beds as swing beds, and you wouldn't be providing any destabilizing effect on community freestanding facilities. You could address the problems that Victor is experiencing in his health district as well as a couple of these other service areas, and that would be something that we would be comfortable, and I think I heard at least indications out of the Department of Human Services representatives that would probably be an approach that they're willing to entertain, and that could actually, I think, help you move the ball down the field on this, but also still keep an eye on responsible resource allocation of taxpayer funds to make sure that Medicare dollars, Medicaid dollars are being spent in the most cost-effective manner. And so that would be, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, probably my suggestion, at least on kind of next sessions and trying to wrap this up for you before noon with a nice red bow on it.
You've done a very marvelous job.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I don't know. Is there any questions, Jim? What I'd like to ask the task force for is permission to create a subcommittee of myself and one other volunteer to look at this and look at some of the complexities that all of the different parties have brought to us. And try to come up with a concept somehow or another that will meet the basic needs and requirements of all of the above. If somebody would be kind enough.
Who needs it the most, Bill Garrard?
What?
That needs it the most?
We don't have a... Do you have anybody
who needs
mentioned?
It the least, and therefore
there you go.
Invested in the outcome.
And I was thinking of Representative Nolan, but district probably does need it the least, and it might be very well for the House in this process of the state to help spread a little bit the education of the problems of Eastern rural and what have you, Oregon. Am I hearing you're volunteering?
Mr. Chair, if you bring your magic wand to the meetings, I would be happy to help you.
Right.
Because I think we may need one.
And I would welcome any other member, since we can have one other person that would like to attend those meetings, without having a quorum of the whole body. So anybody else that wants to, Sandy will be coordinating this, and she'll keep you all informed about it.
Great.
All with your permission.
And whatever you want, whatever makes you happy.
Okay.
Who relished that?
What a deal!
Yeah.
You heard that, spoken from one of the distinguished members of the other party. Whatever I want.
This has taken the birthday thing too far.
Thank you very much, all of you, for your help and presentation. I would expect the department, Jim Bishop, and do you want to be a part of that, or do you want just you want to be a part of that discussion?
Yes, I think that's a great idea.
Mr. Bell?
I'd be happy.
Okay. You have the people who need to be. We probably won't be doing anything on that until a little later in the summer, and the reason for that is my schedule gets a little complicated in the next month here. We want to move something forward on this, at least some understandings forward, if nothing more than that.
I think we can move all the way to
recommend.
We
would then hopefully, if we do something and the group feels like it's worthwhile doing something, then we'd bring it back to the committee with, again, some of the same people to explain to the committee what all has been done.
Excellent.
Okay.
Great
idea.
Okay.
Recess.
We are...
The way you wielded
that. Mr. Carlson, it would be perfectly all right if you were busy, if you sent your able staff to...
I tried to get her up there today.
I know, she copped out on you. I know. We'll be in recess then until 1 o'clock for lunch.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Sandy.
Thank you.
Bit generally about Oregon Project Independence, and I've prepared two handouts for you to have this afternoon. The first is a stapled copy of some information about Oregon Project Independence, and then the second is a single sheet that shows a little bit of comparison about the clients between Medicaid, long-term care, and Oregon Project Independence. On page 2, I've listed the Oregon Project Independence goals and eligibility. OPI began in 1975, and this was prior to the series of Medicaid home and community-based care waivers. And in 1975, OPI was way ahead of the game, at least as far as the rest of the country was concerned. It was an innovative program that was designed to keep people out of Medicaid nursing facilities, and Today, as you heard this morning, Oregon leads the nation in terms of the percentage of clients who are placed in community-based care settings as opposed to nursing facilities. So this was a precursor to the Medicaid home and community-based care waivers. Program goals are listed. They come from the Oregon Administrative Rule 411. They include the promotion of quality of life and independent living among older persons, provide preventive and long-term care services to eligible individuals to reduce the risk of institutionalization. And I've highlighted that. I think that's a real key component to OPI historically. Eligibility down below, no income or asset test per se. However, OPI clients with incomes above 200% of the federal poverty level must pay 100% of their direct service charges through fees, and those between 100 and 200% of the federal poverty level pay on a sliding fee scale. Those below 100% do not pay fees. You must be 60 years or older, or be diagnosed as having Alzheimer's disease or a related disorder. And you must meet the requirements of the long-term care priority rule, which relates most directly to Medicaid long-term care. This is the establishment of survival priority levels, 1 through 18, 1 being the most significantly impaired or limited in terms of activities of daily living, 18 being the least impaired, and we'll look at that a little bit more in a moment. OPI services, they're listed there, and they are listed in statute both in ORS 410.420 and, again, in the Oregon Administrative Rule. They are primarily focused on in-home care. You can see homemaker care, assistance with certain chores, personal care, respite, case management. And then at the bottom, the last bullet includes other services authorized by the Department of Human Services, money management, home modifications, and others to be implemented in 2006-07, which is part of Senate Bill 870, and we'll be talking about that as well. Long-term care planning, public information, and case management. I think it's also useful on the next page to look at the differences between Oregon Project Independence and Medicaid and the similarities. Again, you can see in terms of income eligibility, really again for OPI, there is no income eligibility test, but again the fees are paid depending on the income related to federal poverty level. The Medicaid side, actually, the income eligibility is up to about 220% of federal poverty level, or really 300% of the supplemental security income grant. That's the true standard. Clients in community settings pay room and board under Medicaid. Those in nursing facilities do not. Asset eligibility. There is no asset test, again, for eligibility in Oregon Project Independence. Medicaid, it's very limited, no more than $2,000, excluding home and vehicles and a few other kinds of personal items. Other eligibility requirements, you must be greater than 60 years old, as I said, or be diagnosed with Alzheimer's or a related disorder, and you must meet the Medicaid priority rule. Right now, OPI serves clients in all 18 service priority levels. Medicaid is only funded through 1 through 13. 14 through 17 were cut in 2003. Services provided, again, primarily in-home. Although I've made a note here, there's freedom to be innovative under OPI. This is general fund dollars and other funds, and we have a great deal to say about how the money can be used. Whereas under Medicaid, there are lots of rules about how Medicaid funding can be used to provide services. Having said that, however, in-home services are provided under Medicaid, and in fact, about 49% of the clients in Medicaid long-term care receive in-home services of some kind. In addition, assisted living, foster home services, residential care, and nursing home care as well. Nursing home care is about 15% of our long-term care clients. Federal match, Oregon Project Independence, there is no federal match available for this. Yes, in terms of Medicaid, 39% state funding and 61% federal funding. And I jotted down a note here that says complexity in terms of Medicaid. Again, OPI can be kept fairly simple. We have a great deal to say about how those services are provided. But under Medicaid, this is a system of lots of rules and regulations at the federal level. Changes are difficult to implement because of waiver approvals or state plan amendments that must be approved by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Who administers these programs for OPI? DHS allocates OPI funds to all area agencies on aging. They, in turn, manage the programs. On Medicaid, DHS administers the programs through area agency on agings that have elected to administer Medicaid and also through state offices. Collection on client estates, there is none under OPI, and yes, there is under Medicaid. Again, part of the complexity of the Medicaid program. 2005-07 budget, about $12.25 million in OPI, $1,216.8 million, that's $1.2 billion under Medicaid. It's about 100 times the size of OPI. Now, for a second, I'd like to refer to this other handout that I gave you, a single page.
Did you say billion?
Yes, it's $1.2 billion or $1,216 million. Medicaid, this sheet shows Medicaid compared to OPI for three different factors. The first is survival priority levels. You see them listed 1 through 18. Medicaid on the left-hand side, OPI on the right-hand side, and you can see for December 2005, the distribution of clients for both Medicaid and OPI. I've highlighted those with the highest percentage of clients in them. That would be survival priority level 3, which is defined as requiring full assistance for mobility, cognition, or eating. Level 7, substantial assistance with mobility, assistance with elimination or toileting. Level 10, substantial assistance with mobility. It's interesting to note that about half of the clients in Medicaid are in levels 1 through 5, that is the most significantly impaired or limited. In OPI, about half receive services in levels 14 through 18, which are not even funded under Medicaid, about half there. Gender is pretty close. About 30% are males, 70% females under Medicaid. OPI, 23% male, 77% female, again for the month of December 2005. And you'll note there is a significant difference in terms of age, because, again, OPI serves those over 60 or those diagnosed with Alzheimer's who are under 60 or a related disorder. Now, really, to the OPI budget, which is back on page 5 of that other handout that I gave you. It's located within the Department of Human Services, Senior and People with Disabilities budget cluster. The total DHS budget right now is about $9.9 billion total funds. General fund, a host of sources of other fund revenue, provider taxes, all kinds of things within the other fund category, tobacco taxes, federal Medicaid dollars, federal temporary assistance to needy families dollars, all kinds of federal funds, including food stamps as well. Total DHS budget, about $9.9 billion. SPD, or the Senior and People with Disabilities Cluster, has about a quarter of that, $2.5 billion total funds, $877 million general fund. Of that, $1.2 billion total funds for the adult and people with physical disabilities, Medicaid, long-term care. Now, I want to try and confuse you for a second. The third bullet, OPI budget for 2005-07, $24.25 million, but there's a good bit of duplication in that number, and I'll explain that when we get to a slide on Senate Bill 870. But basically, there is $12 million of general fund within DHS, an appropriation of $12 million general fund, and an additional $12.25 million of other funds expenditure limitation. And as I said, it's duplicative because of Senate Bill 870. The real budget, as I indicated earlier, that is the dollars that can be used for OPI services, is 12.25. OPI funds are distributed by DHS to the area agencies on aging. And the actual biennial expenditures are listed down at the bottom of the page. You can see that they peaked in the 1999-01 biennium at $13 million. And then you can see the result of our budget problems throughout 2001-03 and 03-05, when all budgets were reduced, including this one, down to about $7 million during the 03-05 biennium. 2005-07 budget, 12.25. So far through March, the agency has expended about $4 million, roughly, for 9 months. Important point to remember about the OPI budget, and again, contrasted with Medicaid, is OPI is not an entitlement. And the area agencies on aging have to ration these funds. The funds are capped, and once they're spent, there's rarely any more added to this particular budget. That is not the case on Medicaid. We have to serve people who qualify for Medicaid. By Medicaid law, we are required to serve them. Page 6 talks a little bit about the OPI fees. As noted earlier, OPI clients with incomes above 100% of the federal poverty level must pay some portion of the cost of services. In 2003, during the session, a budget note was implemented requiring DHS to obtain information from the AAAs on the amount of OPI fees that they were collecting, as well as a discussion about how the fee revenue was being used. DHS reported at the November 2004 meeting of the Emergency Board that the AAAs had collected $137,000, but that fee collections were lower than 2003, in part because OPI was being used to assist persons with greater financial need than in years past, and also, I would point out, because the program had been reduced significantly. Fewer clients, less fees to collect. And you can see the actual fee revenue receipts listed there for, and those are annual amounts for state fiscal years. An additional 2003 budget note directed DHS and the AAAs to form a work group to assess feasibility of obtaining Medicaid match for some of the OPI activities. And they concluded that that was not feasible, that it was extremely costly to document all the things that were required to seek reimbursement from the federal government for certain OPI activities. Now to Senate Bill 870. This was passed during the 2005 legislative session. It establishes the Oregon Project Independence Fund, and it consists of monies appropriated directly to the fund, interest, transfers from the senior property tax deferral revolving account, as well as contributions to the fund. And revenue in the fund is continuously appropriated to the Department of Human Services, again, where it's distributed to the AAAs. Senate Bill 870 directed DHS to pay $12 million of general fund that had been appropriated in the DHS budget into the OPI fund, and it provided $12 million of other funds expenditure limitation to DHS to spend the revenue it receives back from the fund, hence the double count, $12 million general fund appropriation, $12 million of other fund expenditure limitation. It also transferred $250,000 from the senior property tax deferral revolving account into the OPI fund, and that transfer has occurred, and the agency received an additional $250,000 of other funds expenditure limitation so that it could actually spend those dollars. Excess funds in the senior property tax deferral revolving account are to be transferred to the OPI fund beginning in the next biennium. Now, excess is defined in Senate Bill 870 as the greater of an account fund balance above $5 million or 35% of the prior tax year payments to counties as of November 30th. November 30th is the low point of the account balance because typically property tax payments were made by the 15th or so of November. So the intent was to protect the revolving account, at least to provide enough money in it so that payments could be made to counties for property tax that had been deferred. But at the same time, if there was excess money, that it be transferred into the OPI, the newly created OPI fund. When funding is sufficient, and 870 does not define sufficiency, DHS must adopt rules to include persons with physical disabilities, those over 19 years of age, or those 19 years of age and above, as eligible to receive OPI, and the second thing it did was to expand services to include public education, web resources, and case management. Now, DHS has not adopted rules yet to include persons with physical disabilities above 18, probably because the funds are not viewed as being sufficient. But again, Senate Bill 870 doesn't define sufficiency. In my questions to DHS about OPI, they indicated that some AAAs have waiting lists for serving the people that are now eligible. So it's questionable as to whether there is sufficient money available to serve a new set of persons at this point in time.
Is that the criteria then that the department is taking?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that question, but I note it as one way, at least in my mind, of telling whether there is sufficiency of funding. Now, that is not necessarily how the department may view it, but they could answer that question. Finally, on the last page, you heard this morning from James Taves about demographic pressures. You've heard this one way or another, aging of the baby boomers. By 2030, the number of persons 65 and older will double in the United States to about 71 million people. And in Oregon, 20 to 30% of the population will be over 65 years old. And this is actually a quotation, the second bullet from the website on the future of long-term care in Oregon within the Department of Human Services. Demand for medical and long-term care services could overwhelm our ability to pay for needed services. So DHS has formed a work group, as Mr. Taves told you this morning, and they are assessing the current system, and they're trying to plan for the future. And I understand from James that a report or a draft report will be coming out pretty soon on this whole topic. The work group has investigated seven key questions, and the fifth question caught my eye with respect to the Oregon Project independence. It asks what non-entitlement-based set of safety net services might be offered to seniors and people with disabilities for whom a little help would delay their need for comprehensive long-term care supports. So that rings the bell for me that they are looking at an OPI kind of a program, wondering what, as I've indicated here, what's the appropriate role of OPI in the future. With that, I'll turn to you for any questions that you might have.
Representative Clark.
John, there was a controversy, I remember back when we were in the cutting mode in the legislature, about those people who were on, at that time, the OPI program, saying that they were eligible for Medicaid. Whereas those same seniors were telling us in our districts, I can't qualify. Does that circumstance still exist?
Mr. Chair and Representative Garrard, I don't know whether to what extent it exists. I guess in my comparison that I showed between OPI and Medicaid, in my mind, there is some overlap between the programs. There are at least some potential there. Because we're dealing with people with incomes primarily below 200% receiving services through OPI, they have to pay fees. So that tells me that, yes, in terms of income, there's an ability perhaps to qualify for Medicaid. Now, on the asset side of things, however, there is no asset test for OPI, which makes me wonder, well, if they were to spend down, would they be eligible for Medicaid? Part of the controversy also was the fact that we were in the process of cutting those higher survival priority levels for which we were receiving match, yet we were attempting to preserve OPI for which there was no match and which arguably served people perhaps with more assets. So I can't answer your question to say, well, yeah, there are a bunch of OPI people that really would qualify for Medicaid. In 2005, I asked the question about, well, how many OPI clients ultimately end up on Medicaid? And I think that the answer was not a whole lot of them. So there are some, for sure, but not a huge number. So that's the best I can do for you.
Good answer. Sorry.
Are there other questions? Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Britton, what does it cost a week for long-term care versus being in a home?
Mr. Chair, in terms of the cost per case, if that's really what you're asking, I can try and answer that one. At least for OPI, and again, this is looking at December 2005, the cost per client was about $234. And again, that's taking an average month of the expenditures throughout the current biennium, dividing it by about 1,961 clients during the month of December, $234. Again, most of those are for in-home kinds of services. Much more costly on the Medicaid side in terms of average costs because we're averaging nursing facility costs, in-home costs, and as I said, about half of them are on the in-home side. Somewhere here in the stack, I have actual costs per case for assisted living, nursing facility, in-home, and I would be happy to give those to you.
Sure,
but they are more than $234 for sure.
I felt surely.
Absolutely. And again, that may be a functioning of rationing the funds very carefully also. Again, OPI funds are capped. Once they're gone, they're gone.
Follow-up, Representative?
Yes, thank you. I'm changing the subject from that. On our veterans' issues, we've been told many times that there are veterans who are receiving Medicare that would really qualify for full veteran benefits. And have you ever done a study on that fiscally?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I haven't done a study on it, but a couple of biennia ago, my recollection is, we implemented a pilot project because one of the things we wanted to do was, if they are eligible for veterans benefits, we want them to be the payer of the cost of long-term care as opposed to Medicaid, to, again, conserve our general fund and federal funds. And we established a pilot project. We were hopeful that it would save the state some money, and I think there was some controversy about whether it did, didn't, whether we should continue those pilot projects or not. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where it stands at this particular point in time.
Would you know where that study is?
Yeah, I probably
could.
I'll try and dig it out.
Okay, thank you.
And I think also there are others in the department that were dealing with that at the time, and they could help answer that question too, but I'll try and find what I can.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Other questions? Do I understand, John, that the full effect of the Senate bill won't be in place for the 07-09 biennium, and that there will need to be appropriations for OPI in that biennium? Or
Mr. Chair, I think so. It's hard to know where the senior tax deferral revolving account stands. And my understanding is that we won't know until November of that year whether there would be a transfer of excess funds. So my guess is that absolutely you'll need to provide an appropriation to DHS or a direct appropriation to the fund. That could also be done.
I bring that up, colleagues, just so that we're not complacent about the needs in the next session. Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Just one more quick question. Maybe I should wait for these other people, but this morning when we were talking about our Medicaid, Medicare prescription program, mm-hmm. We found that there were so few of our seniors enrolled. So I'm just curious, you know, this huge cost that we bear, could it be because we're not contacting these seniors?
Oh, okay. I, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, you're asking about the Medicaid long-term care costs,
right,
relative to the prescription drugs. Well, prior to January 1st of 2006, those costs were part of the Oregon Health Plan, the drug costs, because these persons who are on Medicaid long-term care are also eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. And the Oregon Health Plan was paying for their prescription drug costs through Medicaid, 39-61% split with the federal government. When after the bill was implemented and we converted, and that's what Mary Ellen was talking about this morning, or Mary Jane, I'm sorry. Jane Ellen, gosh, I apologize. Jane Ellen was talking about the transition of all those dual eligibles, the persons that were eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid, to now receive a Medicare drug benefit as opposed to a Medicaid drug benefit. Now, Oregon did end up saving some money when we transitioned from Medicaid to Medicare. Not a great deal, and it looked during the session at about a break-even point. because the savings that we got from not having to pay for the drugs through Medicaid are now paid back to the federal government in the what's known in the vernacular as a clawback payment. So we pay the federal government a share of the cost of providing those Medicare drugs. But all of those dual eligibles, and now the folks that are still on Medicaid long-term care, will be receiving a Medicare drug benefit. And they were transitioned. There were about 50,000 of them, and that's what they've been working hard to transition those folks from Medicaid to Medicare.
Well, thank you, John.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning, this afternoon. Take care.
Yeah. Just tell them to take a piece of cake.
Boy, it's that good. It's carrot cake.
Yeah.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Okay, with that, we'll move on to our next presentation from the Area Agency on Aging. We'll get an update on a whole bunch of things here with Jacqueline Zimmer.
Very short.
I'll join
me. She's the director of Medicaid and Disability Services.
But of course.
Thank you.
We want to know why you're still here.
Today's it.
This is exactly this why I'm still
That's
here.
Today. Celebrate. Or not celebrating, or
thank
say
you.
Goodbye. I didn't mean it like that.
I know. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the last time, for the record, my name is Jacqueline Zimmer, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, O4AD. And joining me today is Mary Shortall, who is the Director of Multnomah County Aging and Disability Services. And Mary is also the Legislative Chair for O4AD, and so I brought her here just in case there were some questions that thought she could probably answer a little better than I could. And if I could for the moment, I think most of you know Nicole Palmatier, who worked with us last session, and she will be taking over for us this next legislative session. So feel free to get a hold of her if you need anything during the interim. But anyway, thank you. It's been a pleasure working with all of you, and it's fun listening to you talk about Senate Bill 870, and everybody here had some sort of role in hand in 870 and what a landmark piece of legislation that is. And if it weren't for that, I wouldn't be changing jobs. The fact that, you...
oh, well, rescind it.
The fact that you allowed us to create and fund a website that helps seniors and people with disabilities and their families find good services in Oregon is the reason that I'm leaving. I'm going to work for Network of Care, which is the website that we have adopted here in Oregon, and I'll give you each a brochure on that and ask you to take a look at the demonstration on the homepage. I think legislators have really become case managers over the years with all of the cuts, and you and your staff will probably benefit from having this up on your screen when people call you and ask you where services are. And beyond that, there's a million things on there that we didn't realize were available. It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful site. So I'll leave a brochure with all of you, but thank you for the opportunity to work with you all these past 12 years and 12 sessions. Today we had the opportunity, I think, to talk to you about Oregon Project Independence. We're going to touch on the Meals on Wheels issue just a bit. And, of course, I wouldn't be who I am if I didn't just quickly mention the equity issue to you for the AAAs. And also for your future perusal, we brought some pilot project proposals, some ideas for next session that sort of follow along in that vein that John Britton mentioned. The Long-Term Care Committee is looking at ideas and proposals for projects that could help us divert people from Medicaid, find services that they need early on, and keep them from becoming residents in nursing homes and more extensive living facilities. So that's sort of the overall what we brought for you today. And I think that John did a nice job of bringing you up to speed on OPI, but if you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chair, I think we'd like to just there were a couple of questions that you asked that I think that we could answer for you about OPI and how it's working and the funding for next session. And so I'll answer a few of them, and then Mary, if you would join in. I think, Mr. Chair, you asked the question about whether or not we'll need general fund for Oregon Project Independence next session, and I think that the answer is yes, we will need it in the governor's recommended budget for several reasons, and one of them is that Oregon Project Independence is Oregon's contribution to the maintenance of effort needed to pull down Older Americans Act dollars. So we always need to leave, the state needs to show the federal government that we support long-term care services as well, so that we can pull down all of the other federal dollars that the Older Americans Act provides in the way of services in Oregon. So you'll need to put in, I think, at least, is it 3.1 million?
I think it's 10%.
So and you will need to encourage the governor to include. This report says that, you know, if you understand correctly, this talks about $25.5 million in Oregon Project Independence, and I hope you understand that it's really 12.25, I think, is actually what's in there. So for the biennium, it's not $24 million, and we'd be thrilled if it was, and someday it will be, but right now it's not. So you will need to encourage the governor to put funding into Oregon Project Independence for next session, and then we'll just see how much money is in there. We never know who's going to pay back their property tax deferral. We just don't know what kind of money is going to be in that account. But in years past, the legislature has enjoyed $22 to $24 million from that fund. So we're thrilled that it's been dedicated to this program. Do you have anything to add to that, Mary? So another thing, and I know he mentioned that people do pay in as they can to Oregon Project Independence, and John always questions sort of the need for OPI in areas of the state where people do have resources. But the reason that we have OPI and that it is statewide is that in some parts of the state there are no Kimberly Quality Care, there are no, you know, Harold's Home Care services. There aren't services for those people to buy in their own community. They go to the Area Agency on Aging and they buy their services through us. So until there's home care services in every single community, you'll always need OPI to fill that gap and help people remain in their own homes, in their own communities, with their own friends where they want to be. So that's really important to keep that in mind, I think, whenever anyone raises that question about why people with income and assets are using OPI. And if they have income and they have assets, they're paying. They're paying into the services. So keep that in mind as well. Can you add anything to that, Mary?
Well, I was just thinking that Representative Garrard's question also, I think, had to do with the fact that during the last legislative session, OPI had been cut back to about 50% of what it used to be. And so that probably also contributed quite a bit to your constituents that could not get OPI services. So
many people who were formerly on Medicaid are using Oregon Project Independence. We don't have actual numbers on that, but we know that we tried to refer them to OPI when they lost levels 14 through 17, and in fact then there weren't many dollars in OPI at that time, so a lot of people just kind of gave up and have been slow to come back to OPI in some areas because they don't think they're not so when we say we're from the government, we're here to help, we've heard that before. So, but word is getting out, and the fact that we have waiting lists in some parts of our state indicate that people do need the services and want to be able to take advantage of it. So we've provided you with a document that tells you in almost every area of the state how many people we're serving, whether or not there's a waiting list, how many people we were serving before we modernized OPI, and the average hours per client, and what each area is receiving in the way of OPI dollars. So if you want to take a look at your own community, for example, here in the Salem area, they have a waiting list for OPI already. But they're Marion, Polk, Yamhill, Clatsop, and Tillamook County, and in the other communities, They don't have a waiting list. They're adding people. But they know they'll be at capacity. So this is just one of those programs that's never going to run out of people that want to use it. So.
Sure. Representative Gardner.
Jacqueline, is there a preset amount for each area? Or how do you apply those funds statewide?
Well, this is probably a good question for actually for the seniors and persons with disabilities staff, but it is a formula, and it's based, I think, on probably a similar formula to the way the Older Americans Act funding is put out. So,
what happens anymore in Oregon Project Independence, and Chair Representative Gerard, is that people have each area has its set allocation, and I believe that's based on population and
income,
and then we just try to. No one's getting what they need, all the hours that they need, all the care that they need under Oregon Project Independence. People are getting sort of the minimum that we can get away with, and we do things like try to put other pieces to a care plan together for them that involve neighbors and friends and family and such and so forth. But for the most part, we just try to make our dollars go far, try to help people at a base level and move on to the next client from there.
Follow up.
In that, it's interesting that there are waiting lists in some areas, none in others. If an area that doesn't have a waiting list still has, is it possible for them to have excess funds that could be allocated to another area where there is a waiting list?
That's a good question. And what the Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities have done over the last few years is that we've set up a method so that for the second year of the biennium, we do try to reallocate money, shift money from one area to another, as we think we, you know, have that capability to do so. I think the trust fund will change that whole process, though. So I think as we're working on have a work group to try to implement Senate Bill 870, you know, I think some of that will possibly have to change. The other thing I would say is that I don't think anybody really has excess OPI, hardly ever. For example, in Multnomah County, we too have a waiting list now. It started in March, and we now have 97 people on it, and 3 people died just during the waiting time already. And this is the first year of the biennium. And I think a lot of it now is going to, it has to do with the fact that OPI has been cut back and there is, you know, continuing or growing demand for that sort of service as the Medicaid program has been cut. We also try to find, you know, we cobble together what extra kinds of funding we can. You know, it's pretty easy to raise, I shouldn't say easy, but it's easier to raise funding for, you know, like home-delivered meals in our metro area because we contract out to a provider that's able to run a really good campaign. So we're blessed that way. Lots of rural areas cannot do that. They're delivering their own home-delivered meals through Older Americans Act. But because we don't have to put a lot of extra money into those things, we put most of our OPI money into case management and into in-home services. So every area is unique, just depending on what their resources are.
So the AAAs are very good to each other and pay attention to each other's needs and I've been impressed over the years with how they've shifted money when they needed to other areas where there was a really great demand. So that's the beauty of this particular program is that it really is grassroots and down at the so at such a local level that it can really be effective, I think, in those kind of ways. So I hope that answers your question.
Yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. I think that sort of the last thing I could say about Oregon Project Independence is that, and Mary mentioned it briefly, when we cut levels 14 through 17 and we made it harder for folks to get Medicaid services and we cut OPI. We did set ourselves up as a state to have people be mandatorily more impaired before we would help them, and that's playing out now. And I'm really hoping that the Modernization Act, once the funding gets there, it helps turn that back around, and we don't have to tell people that 2 years ago they really would have been eligible for some help, but now they're not. And so I'm really hopeful that this fund grows fast and that we're able to. It would be wonderful to double what's in there next biennium. So, but thank you for everything that you did to make that go. It's a great bill. Any other questions about that?
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Jacqueline. I just want to tell you it's been an honor and a pleasure to work with you, and you've got the greatest heart,
thank
most
you.
Professional, and a lot of us owe so much to you. And we just want you to have the best life, and thank you for all your help for so many.
You're very welcome. Thank you. I've enjoyed it, most of it. we're going to talk about the Meals on Wheels issue as well. And boy, 12 sessions in 12 years, and you learn something new every day. We have an issue with the Meals on Wheels program, and I know I don't have to explain the value of that to you, but the rates for Meals on Wheels have not been increased, I think, since 2001, and you can just imagine that the costs have gone up since 2001, and what we have in some areas, again, are waiting lists for Meals on Wheels, just no intakes at all, we have a comprehensive long-term care system here in Oregon, and Meals on Wheels is a significant part of it. And last session during rebalance, which was in the spring, we mistakenly assumed that we were going to get an increase in Meals on Wheels. It was a very hectic, chaotic time for the Ways and Means Committee and Representative Richardson. And as they say in Costa Rica, there was a confusion. Mm-hmm. And we did not get the increase. And we agreed to stand down and have that increase come to us in November at the e-board. And it didn't happen then. And then there was a shift in the DHS leadership and such and so forth. That went kind of on and on. And here it is, May something. And we have statistics for you that we collected during 2004 that talked about our costs. I mistakenly thought that we were going to do it at the next e-board, but I know there's much support among leadership to do something about it, but apparently there's no money to be handed out at the next e-board. It's a November type of, twice a year type of thing. Julia Huddleston informed me of that yesterday. So, you know, we are going to have the issue until it's resolved of people not getting meals and not getting checked on and no one doing a daily check-in with them and maybe the only contact they have. And at the time of the rebalance last June, the dollar amount that we were looking for based on 2004 numbers was about $150,000. And it's been awful to watch the Department of Human Services leak money for shortfalls and whatnot and not be able to come up with $150,000.
Sure.
We're guessing it's probably a little closer to $200,000, maybe more now. I don't really know. But we need to increase the average rate per meal by about, it's a little under, it's about a buck per meal. Kind of just brings us to a point where we can continue to do business as we should. So I want to make you very aware of that. And as you're talking in your caucuses about upcoming e-boards and budgets and whatnot, I hope you'll consider that issue to be one of our most serious issues. Anything to add to that? Mary's right. Meals on Wheels is interesting all over the state. You know, there's when the state's providing a program to people, you write the check. And when the AAAs are providing a program, we get money from a number of different sources, but we go out and fundraise, and that's unique and different, and it's our pleasure, but it makes it difficult to sort of always know how much money you're going to get. In Representative Garrard's area, Taco Bell comes into the senior center there and does the meal once a week. That's a very unique arrangement. Every community has something different going on, but the communities are involved in what we do and whatnot. But the state really needs to do its part. The communities can't carry all the weight. So.
Actually, I do want to add something to it. This is really the Medicaid meals, right? The cost for the Medicaid meals. So in a way, the right now the local area is subsidizing Medicaid because we do that fundraising and keep those meal costs down. So to me, it seems like it is something that should be funded and as soon as possible, actually.
So. There's that. I'm just going to touch briefly on the equity issue because we have some new numbers for you. I think everybody here is familiar with it, and I think you're indulging me at this point, so I'll be quick. But, in all my years here, whenever anyone said they would be quick, it was the longest testimony ever. Mm-hmm. But, so
we know you're leaving. So,
so this would be no time to start acting like Ralph Groner because I really want to get out of here. The equity issue for the Area Agency on Aging is a long-standing issue, and unfortunately, the entities that the state partners with to have them deliver services are delighted to do the work for them, but. So many are not being reimbursed at an adequate rate, but we like to say we're number one. We were the first, I think, state partnership system to be abused. What's the word for it? It's not a very nice word, but we are, pardon me?
Slighted.
That's a nice word for it, right. So in some areas of the state, we're really running at about 80% of what we should be receiving to conduct business. The Department of Human Services, and we love Bruce Goldberg, and we're so thrilled to have James Taze and his staff there. We can't blame him for this. It's the legislature that really needs to correct this issue. And counties were never, and local governments were never agreed to subsidize the state when they're delivering these programs. And if we gave all of them back to you today, you would need to come up with about $6 million in general fund. And then, of course, there's a federal match to that. And, the demographics tell us this population is growing, and you can understand the issues that come along with being funded at 80% of what you need to do your job. I know you don't make very much money, but what if we only gave you 80% of the $1,200 or the $1,400 that you were getting? So, there are significant risks with that, but there are a lot of benefits with fixing that, and we hope that that you will, in your caucuses and in your conversations with the governor, encourage him to fully fund the area agencies on aging. We have agreed to do it at 95% of what it would cost the state. That's a nice offer, and we think that... It's way past time to correct that particular issue. It's my one regret that I didn't get that done before I left. But the statute now, it's now in statute that the state needs to address this particular issue. So don't make me come back. Any questions on that? Okay. And then I'll let you read because in the interest of time, we have some pilot project proposals, more senior companion, some workload simplification, senior peer counseling, and more volunteer visitation type programs. We'd love to have some pilot programs set up around the state that are pretty low cost. We've included what we think are the general costs for doing these kinds of things and the benefits that you'll get from it, and hopefully the Medicaid diversion that you will then experience as a result of, again, helping people at the front door instead of keeping them from coming in at all. Are any questions? Good go.
Question?
I missed you.
Thank you.
Are you going to come back?
I am. I've kept my house, so if anyone needs a house to rent, I have a nice house. And I assume someday I'd like to come back. I don't think anybody can really afford to live in Marin County, so we'll see how long I last. But it's a nice change for me, and it's a great company, so I look forward to it. But call me if you have any questions as you're going through the process, if I can help you with anything.
You're going to Marin County?
I am.
Mill Valley.
Mill Valley.
Mill Valley. Valley girl.
Oh, my.
Well, it's not.
You're giving up stuff for.
For Schwarzenegger. Go ahead and say it.
She's infiltrating.
That's right. That's what I'm doing.
I happen to have had a conversation with Jacqueline a couple weeks ago, and I have a nephew who is the sheriff in the county that she's going to.
Oh, good.
And so I've called him to advise him to check all campgrounds every week so he can find me.
I have a cousin who is a shrink in that county, too. If you have some needs in that area, let me know.
We all wish you well.
I think we're looking
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
We do wish you well, Jacqueline. Thank you very much.
We will miss you. As I get tripped going down the hall by this lady. Mm-hmm. You know, say, you see what they've done to it. I'll miss that. I genuinely appreciate the work you've done for seniors since I've been in the legislature, and you will be missed.
Thank you very much. I'll miss it. All right. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today.
Okay. According to the official document here, we have still 20 minutes left for public comment.
Anyone who wants to roast Jacqueline before she gets out of the building.
This would be an absolutely perfect time to do it. Anyone for public comment? I have no one signed up. Hearing no one, we are adjourned until the chair calls the next meeting.
Thank you.
Okay. Nice job, Bob.
Excellent work.
We're out of here. Almost.
And please, we have plenty of cake.
Eat.